tree!
All right, it's Halloween. Well, I don't really have any candy for you guys. Let me see what I got here. Hold on one second. I know I have to have something here. Oh, here we go. You know what? How about a copy of TNA's balance sheet?
Welcome to the 2016 Halloween edition of the Solomonster Sounds Off, and now here's your host with the most, the Solomonster.
Thank you, Zombie Solomonster. It's good to see you again.
Did you have a chance to see last weekend's Walking Dead?
Yes, unfortunately I did.
Well, what'd you think?
I really don't want to talk about it. I'm still very depressed.
I loved it.
All right, thank you, Zombie Solomonster. This is episode 467 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here, Halloween edition 2016. I'm the Solomonster. I did watch Walking Dead last Sunday. I will say without any spoilers or anything for people who may eventually watch, that was the most traumatizing hour of television I've ever seen. There have been some three-hour Raws that have come close, including whatever the hell that was last Monday. So there's been a lot of hour threes that have been pretty traumatizing, but nothing like this. This was on a whole other level. And I enjoyed it, I guess, in kind of a sick way, but man, it has stuck with me all week. So, and the show just keeps trudging on, you know, 17 million people tuned in. It was either a record or close to a record. For a season premiere. They already greenlit season 8 before season 7 even began. So say what you want to about the show if you're not a fan of it, but they must be doing something right. I want to plug The Death of WCW for a reason, because that is one of the more popular audiobooks on Audible that you guys have been cashing in on using our link. And so if you would like to use your free book to download The Death of WCW audiobook, you can do so. audibletrial.com/solomonster. That's our link. You punch that in, go through the sign-up process. Audible will give you a free trial of the service for 30 days using our link, and you can cash in to get one free audiobook that even if you cancel your trial before the 30 days are up, if you don't like it, you can't afford it right now, whatever the case may be, that book, be it The Death of WCW or Brock Lesnar's Death Clutch, or Chris Jericho's book, or Steve Austin's book, or Hulk Hogan, or Daniel Bryan's, are all on there. They're all on the list. You get to keep that book no matter what. So take advantage of that. We had a very good October so far. Very good September, too. I want to keep that ball rolling until the end of the year. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. If you've already used the link, you can pass that along to friends or family who you think may get some use out of it. And you are supporting the podcast when you do so. Also, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, the most direct way to support the podcast, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. $30 or more will get you a shout-out and a quick plug for your own podcast or business. And again, if you like what you hear, you can consider making a donation, as these fine people have done. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Kind of a Big Deal Corey Blake, Misfit Miguel Mendoza, Pull No Punches Alan Ragasa, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, The Boss Carlos Torrens, The Marietta Mahler Alexandru Mata, almost butchered his name there, So Nice I'll Say It Twice, The Marietta Mahler, Alexandru Mata, Virginia Dynamite, Dwayne Horley, Anthony Gorilla Press Gonzalez, The Thunder from Down Under, Jack Williams, The Chapel Hill High Flyer, Kyle George, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Prairie State Pariah, Kenneth Johnson, Raymond the Mountie Medina. I want to also give a shout out to one of our listeners. Her and her husband have been listening to the podcast for 5 years, Terry from Houston. She was recently diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. And she wants to let everybody know, all the women out there, this is still Breast Cancer Awareness Month, to get themselves checked, that breast cancer can happen to anyone at any age, and that if breastfeeding moms feel a lump that they assume is a clogged duct, please get it checked, because if it's been longer than 2 weeks, that could be a sign of trouble. Of course, I've talked about my own mother, what she's going through. Breast cancer is a terrible thing. I'm very sorry to hear that. But Terry just wanted to get that message out there to any women who are listening, even the guys who are listening. If you have your wife, your girlfriend, this is something that they all need to be aware of. And if you want to follow along with Terry's journey, she has a Facebook page set up, facebook.com/fightmamafight. That's mama with one M, M-A-M-A. So it's facebook.com/fightmamafight. You can show her some love on that page and follow along with her journey. Again, Terry, I'm very sorry to hear that. At powerful__. That's the shout out this person wanted without their name being given. That's at powerful. That's two L's. __. Paul Money in the Banks, who turned 57 this past week. Happy birthday to Paul from your son, Michael Badman Banks, and all the rest of your children. Jess the Barber McDermott. And you can check out Color Commentary. That's Color Commentary fan page on Facebook, facebook.com/color commentary. By the way, Color Commentary has a U in there, so it's C-O-L-O-U-R commentary. It's a place to talk wrestling and post memes. What could be more fun than that? Also, Christian Combat Reyes, who has a YouTube channel you can check out. His username on there is cbars82, all one word. The Black Buck, Matt Harrigan, got to show him some love. Again, he is running his Superkick the Holidays fundraiser to buy gear from independent wrestlers to help clothe the homeless this winter. It's a great cause indeed. Please support it. Superkickfoundation.org is the place to go. And I want to give a shout out to WrestleStars.com. That's WrestleStars with a Z at the end. This is pretty cool. WrestleStars is a live-action role-playing game. Makes use of what's called turn-based strategy. It's a fantasy wrestling game that was inspired by the likes of Wrestler Unstoppable and EWR, Extreme Warfare Revenge. I'm sure a lot of you have at least heard of EWR before. I even played it a bit myself many years ago. Many, many years ago. So you create, a wrestling persona. You compete in a bunch of different match types. You can build your own storylines and play with your friends, interact with other players. It's pretty cool stuff. You can check it out right now. Sign up at WrestleStars.com. Also got to give a shout out to Wrestle Rumble. Wrestle Rumble is hosting its Hell in a Cell Pick'em contest for the pay-per-view tonight. Oh yes, there is a pay-per-view tonight. You can go to WrestleRumble.com, fill out your entry form. The pools are still open. $10 for a single entry. $20 will get you 3 entries. And that's big because the first place winner gets $500 and 2 luxury suite tickets to the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome. That is courtesy of TicketKingOnline.com. Second and third place winners get $100 each. So make sure you get those entries in by 8 p.m. Eastern tonight. If you are listening to this on a Monday or a Tuesday, obviously it is over. But if you are listening to this, it is Sunday here, Hell in a Cell. You have until 8 p.m. Eastern tonight when the pay-per-view begins to get your entry forms in. So go to WrestleRumble.com. I want to correct a mistake I made on last week's show when I was talking about the Raw ratings and the bump that the show got from Goldberg's debut. I made a comparison to Sting's debut on Raw, which I said came the night after Survivor Series a couple of years ago. And it got almost 5 million viewers for that opening segment. The point that I was trying to make is still valid. It was still a valid point, but I was wrong in that Sting's debut actually happened on the Raw. It was in January. So that was a full 2 months later that he actually debuted on Raw. People were anticipating an appearance by Sting the night after Survivor Series. That was when he saved Dolph Ziggler and helped him win the main event. And even though he didn't show up on that show, as it turns out, people didn't know that he wasn't going to be there. And so, they did that gigantic number. That's why I say my point still stands. But I apologize. I got it wrong. I've had people in the past call me a wrestling encyclopedia before. Well, even the encyclopedia has a misprint every now and then. So, again, I apologize. Flow Sports. Well, may as well start with this. I mean, there's so much to get to this week, but I want to just knock this out of the way first. There was a big announcement this week from Flow Sports. They have started a new venture called Flow Slam, which is an online wrestling streaming service. $20 for a monthly subscription to everything. They do have apps available on Apple TV and Roku. They already have a deal in place with Gabe Sapolsky, his WWN Live family of promotions, I guess you would say. That includes Evolve, Shine, which is the all-women's promotion, and Full Impact Pro, I think, which is down in Florida. Plus all of their past events, their entire tape library, all the new events, all the different Evolve shows. They already have a bunch of Evolve shows available to stream right now, if you go on the website. So this kind of came out of nowhere, kind of. And I guess if you are a fan of independent wrestling, especially if you are a fan of Evolve, if you look at the economics of it, if you are somebody who usually watches all of the Evolve shows, I don't know how much each individual Evolve show typically went for. Maybe $15, $20, whatever it was. This subscription will net you access to, my understanding is, every Evolve show. So you pay one flat fee going forward, and besides the library, you get all of the new shows. And I think they're saying producing up to 60 events a year. So if you're an Evolve fan, it sounds like a pretty good deal. Now, what's interesting about Evolve being involved, is because of that survey that WWE sent out a few weeks ago, asking about tiered pricing options for the WWE Network, and what would you think if we carried independent wrestling content? They specifically mentioned TNA and ROH. Evolve has a relationship already with WWE, so you would think that if they ever did move forward with tiered pricing and they were offering outside independent content on their own network, Evolve would have been involved in that. That will not happen now. Although the relationship with WWE continues on, I know William Regal is going to be scouting at another Evolve show in a few weeks, so it's not like the relationship is dead. It's just very weird to me, because again, you would think they would be first in line if WWE ever did move forward with that. And for at least, I think it was in the Observer, they said that this is like an exclusive 5-year deal, so for at least 5 years, that will not happen. Supposedly, these Flow Sports people are also going after Ring of Honor and New Japan, and, you know, I've heard, yeah, PWG, I don't think that's going to happen. PWG is interesting because if you're a fan of PWG, and I just answered a question about them in the mailbag a few weeks ago, one of the things that people find so cool about PWG is the fact that you've got wrestlers from all over the place. I mean, you've got wrestlers who you might see competing in TNA or Ring of Honor who are allowed to do PWG because they don't stream, right? They have their shows in their little 400-seat building, and they could probably move into a bigger building 2 or 3 times the size of that, but they don't want to. So they do their shows, and it's almost like it feels like something that you've got to be part of, and so everybody wants to be part of it, and because you can't necessarily get into every show, I mean, there have been stories of celebrities who have been turned away at the door. And there is something, I think, to that strategy of making your product feel like it's can't miss, must see, you'd be a special person to get a ticket or something like that. But I guess if they were to start streaming events, they wouldn't be able to use a lot of that talent. That would take away from the allure of PWG. So I don't know that they're going to be part of this whole thing, but they are supposedly going after a whole bunch of independent promotions and promotions that are even bigger than independents. So I guess they'll roll that out over the weeks and months to come. We'll find out who else that they have signed a deal with. Right now, it's just Evolve, as far as I know. What's also weird is that this would be direct competition. This is direct competition to the WWE Network. And yet, WWE has invested in Flow Sports. Back in August, it was announced that WWE was part of a $20 million round of funding in this company, in this venture, along with a bunch of other companies. WWE didn't pump in $20 million on its own, but it was part of that round of funding, and so I'm not really sure how involved WWE is, if they just have a little piece of it, I don't know. But they put money into this thing, they backed this thing, and now a few months later, all of a sudden, they're trying to sign up all these independent promotions, when WWE had just put a survey out 2 or 3 weeks ago asking people, hey, what would you think if we offered outside content on our own network? So there's there's direct competition going on here. It's just the timing of this is very weird. My view on this, as far as success or failure, I mean, this thing is going to live or die based on the diehards. That's really what this is all about. I mean, you look at that subscription price, $20 a month. The WWE Network is $9.99, and they probably could and should be charging more than that. Like, me personally, for the content that it gives and the library and everything else, like, I like the network. If the network jacked up its price to $12.99, I'd probably still pay for the network. If the network was $15, I would pay for the network. I don't really know what my breaking point is. 20 might be it. 20 is, you know, if they ever jack their price up to $19.99 a month, that's a $10 increase over what they currently charge, I think they're going to be in a lot of trouble. So even WWE, with 4,000 some odd hours of content and all the live programming and everything else, they don't even charge that much money. But if you are a diehard wrestling fan and you're into the independent promotions, you know, that to me would seem like the target demographic. How big that demographic is, how willing they are to drop that kind of money, I guess we're going to find out. But to me, that's the only audience that they could go after. I mean, it's not a bad deal. Again, if you're into these promotions, instead of paying per show, you pay one price and get everything. But again, they're assuming they can get enough of those diehards to pay $20 a month. And if they can't, I guarantee you, you're not getting casual fans to pay even half that to watch a bunch of indie promotions. That ain't happening. So we'll see if the hardcore fans come out and they support this thing, because if they don't, I think this thing is going to die on the vine. Now, I mentioned Hell in a Cell before. Hell in a Cell is tonight. I am going to do Hell in a Cell predictions, but it's a Raw brand pay-per-view, so we may as well talk about the last Raw before Hell in a Cell, and then we'll get into the predictions. Maybe we'll get this out of the way first, because I got a lot to say about this show. Mundane Night Raw was live from Minneapolis, Minnesota last Monday. I think this Twitter poll that I put up pretty much says it all. Almost 2,000 of you voted. This may be the most lopsided poll, or if not the most, one of the most lopsided polls I've ever done. 14% of you said thumbs up. 86% of you say thumbs down. Which is great, coming 6 days before a pay-per-view. You know, they're promoting a Halloween edition of Raw this Monday. Raw happens to fall on Halloween this year. I don't know. This was a pretty frightening episode of Raw right here. Which is a nice way of saying it sucked. This show sucked. And I am as big a fan of Chris Jericho and the list as anyone. I'm really digging Jericho's stuff. I don't want him to go away anytime soon. But they did a show-long storyline centered around Seth Rollins stealing Jericho's list. He stole the list of Jericho. And Jericho just refuses to wrestle in the main event. He was scheduled to be in the main event against Kevin Owens and Seth Rollins in a triple threat match. He says, nope, I'm not wrestling. I'm out of the main event. I'm not wrestling unless I get my list back. And it took Stephanie McMahon midway through the show threatening to suspend him to get him to wrestle. Okay? This is a show where the age of the average viewer is something like 40 years old, maybe over 40 years old. And I'm watching grown men fighting over a list. And this is supposed to get me excited for Seth Rollins challenging Kevin Owens for the Universal title tonight. And Jericho ended up wrestling anyway, like nothing ever happened. So this was a colossal waste of time. We had Enzo Amore. Enzo Amore pinned Carl Anderson. Right? I think everybody's pinned Carl Anderson by now. Now, he's lost a couple of matches in the lead up to this match. I'm sure that him and Gallows will get the win tonight over Cass and Enzo. And at this point, who could possibly give a shit? Right? Who could possibly care? So they win tonight. Big deal. What does it even matter at this point? Cesaro and Sheamus beat the New Day in a non-title warm-up to their championship match tonight. Not sure why we had to see this twice, since the title match was already announced even before this, but there it was. It was good. For what it was, I thought it was a good match. Sheamus and Cesaro finally beginning to gel as a team. But they've built up this streak for so long with the New Day as tag team champions, 400 and some odd days, and they've teased them, you know, breaking Demolition's record, that honestly, I would just keep the belts on them until they get at least closer. I don't know if the plan is to break the record, if the plan is to come close to the record and get heat on somebody for ending the record before they can break it. I don't know what their plans are. I don't even care either way. You know, some people would be mortified if they break Demolition's, or who gives a shit? Like, it doesn't even matter. So if they want to break the record, at this point I say go for it, break the record. Tonight, to take the titles off of them, to me, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We have Dana Brooke. Dana Brooke challenged Bayley on this show to an arm wrestling contest. The people were so excited for this, they chanted, "Boring," and "We want wrestling." She's not been on the main roster, Bayley, for more than a month or two, and they have already found a way to get the crowd to chant, "Boring," during a Bayley segment. That takes talent. That really takes talent. Way to go, guys. That takes talent. So Dana attacked Bayley. Bayley came back, hit her with a very ugly-looking belly to Bayley. Dana rolled out of the ring. This was not good. This was not good on any level. Other than, they now have officially announced the singles match between these two for the pay-per-view, so they were trying to further the feud. They failed. Curtis Axel. Curtis Axel got promo time on this show before his match with Bo Dallas. He was super over because they were in the Twin Cities, which is where his grandfather came up and his father came up. Father won the AWA championship, so he's the hometown boy. So then Bo Dallas comes out, of course, and pins him clean with a cradle in 3 minutes. Not only that, this is very weird. If Axel's tweets are to be believed, and it's not just some sort of weird angle, there were Curtis Axel signs being confiscated by arena security because fans were tweeting him saying, "Hey, dude, I brought a sign for you," but they took it away. There were at least two or three people, if not more, who said this. And so Axel went on social media and said, "Why are Axel signs or Axelmania signs being confiscated?" That's a really good question. Why would they do that, given that they were in Minneapolis? But you know what? Given that they were in Minneapolis, I also have no idea why they thought that that Brock Lesnar segment later in the show would be a good idea. We'll get to that in a second. What else do we have on this wonderful show? Oh, Titus O'Neil. Titus O'Neil is apparently now with the Shining Stars. And that's good. I say that's a good thing. Now all we have to do is get Goldust and R-Truth and throw Bo Dallas in there. Get all the mid-card guys all rounded up. Makes it easier to throw a net on all of them backstage, so they can't come out on TV and we don't have to see them. Just kind of bunch them all together. So Titus was in their corner against the Golden Truth, who's, if I haven't mentioned this by now, their remixed music sucks. Mark Henry was in the Golden Truth's corner, and the finish of this match was so contrived. It was one of those moments where if you're watching it with like a non-wrestling fan, they probably would just look at it and shake their head and walk out of the room. I'm wincing all over again, just kind of thinking back to it, and this show hasn't aired on TV for 6 days. So what happened was Mark Henry was supposed to shove Titus back into the ring. I guess he was supposed to shove him back into the ring post while one of the Shining jobbers was on the top rope, and he'd be knocked off balance and he would crotch himself on top. Well, instead, Mark Henry shoved Titus, and Titus, I don't even know how to describe this. He did this sort of delayed jump. Like, he jumped backwards, landed on his ass, like in a sitting position on the apron. And the Shining Dingbat up top sold it anyway and fell down. This was shit. I mean, this was just total shit. But again, it's an undercard match. It's not a big deal. I just couldn't believe the sequence of events there at the end that led to the finish. I just thought this is amateur hour here. Mick Foley. Here's a segment on this show that's been the subject of a lot of feedback, both good and bad. People wondering, well, what'd you think of this segment, man? Wasn't Mick Foley just terrible? Wasn't he this? Wasn't he that? Mick Foley came out to officiate the contract signing for the women's championship match between Sasha Banks and Charlotte. Foley did not start off well. He was delivering these very overly scripted lines about how historic the match is, it's a new era, and all that kind of stuff, which we've heard a gazillion times. But then we got to see glimpses of the Mick Foley of old. And I know some people may disagree with me on this, but I don't care. The Mick Foley that we saw here, this is the Mick Foley that got people invested in what he used to say, right? He kept asking them, are you sure you want this, right? He was being mellow GM Mick Foley. Are you sure you want to be in this Hell in a Cell match? Do you know what you're getting yourselves into? Are you sure you know, you're positive? And when they said yes, all of a sudden, he started shouting. Now, there was an element to this where I was kind of like... I was kind of laughing a little bit, thinking, man, he's coming off as like a crazy old man, just randomly shouting. In fact, that could be a new gimmick for Mick Foley. I was thinking that we could have like Angry Foley, where in just random segments on the show, he comes from out of nowhere and just starts raving like a lunatic. That could be a new gimmick for him. But he starts shouting about, you have no idea what punishment you're in for. And he called the cell, it's a living, breathing entity. It has no soul. It has no conscience. So the cell fits right into the wrestling business. He told them to look at me, look at me, look at the future that you could be looking at for yourselves. He said, you see the way I walk? You see how difficult it is for me to get around? I walk that way because it hurts. He says, no matter how much weight I might lose, my hip, it's bone on bone. I live in pain every single day of my life because of what happened to me inside that cell. Well, outside too, I guess, not just inside. I thought Foley did a masterful job here. This was the closest thing to the Foley of old that we've seen since he came back. And I want to make that clear before I say anything else, because I think Foley did a great job. It was probably the highlight of the show, which I know is a low bar to set. It's not really saying much, but I thought it was probably the highlight of the entire show. Now, that said, it did ring a bit hollow because of how these Hell in a Cell matches are today. Now, him in there talking about how going in and not coming out the same way, right? Okay. Guys like Shawn Michaels, guys like The Undertaker, guys like Triple H, they could all say the same thing because those guys, they had wars inside that cell, right? They were in the cell, they were on top of the cell, they bled, they this, they that. Today, we don't see those kinds of matches anymore. It's very rare. We don't really get that out of Hell in a Cell. It's one of the reasons why people don't care about the cell the way they used to. Nobody really buys that this is a dangerous match anymore. I mean, guys get hurt. I mean, what was it, last year or the year before, they did one with Undertaker and Brock. I think Brock bled. I don't remember, but every now and then we'll see a little bit of blood or we'll see something that's kind of violent. But by and large, these cell matches are not this violent, career-altering spectacle that they still advertise it to be. It's like they're still advertising Hell in a Cell like it was 1998. It ain't 1998 anymore. And when it was over, it just rang a little hollow for me, and I think that's the problem. They did exactly what they needed to do here. It's not even like they did something wrong. If I were them promoting a Hell in a Cell, I would want to promote this thing like it was the most dangerous match in the world. I'm not even saying they're wrong for doing that, but because of the way that they treat these matches now, I don't know that anybody really buys it. I really don't. I mean, maybe the little kids do. I'm sure the little kids do. Okay, but again, the little kids are not the ones that you're trying to get to order the pay-per-view. They're not the ones that are going to go, hey, I want the network. You've got to convince people that this is a dangerous, violent match. And by the way, if it is just being geared to kids, it's a hell of a message to send. Hey, you know, hey kids, we want you to see this ultra-violent match. So they may buy it, but I'm not buying it. I don't think you're buying it, right? So they did exactly what they had to do, but it just doesn't work anymore. We've been desensitized to it. We know that it's not what it used to be. And like I said, I'm willing to bet that I'm not the only one who feels that way. Rich Swann beat Brian Kendrick, the same Brian Kendrick challenging for the Cruiserweight title tonight. Now, if Kendrick wins the championship, then this makes sense because it sets up his next challenger. If he doesn't, then the timing of this really doesn't make any sense at all. And by the way, we got a backstage segment later on in the show with TJ Perkins and Brian Kendrick, where Kendrick cried that he needs to win. I need this win, because this is it for me. This is, if I don't win this title, this is my last shot. All the stuff that we heard him say in the Cruiserweight Classic, which was really powerful stuff the first time that he talked about it. And then he lost, right? In the tournament, he lost. I think it was Kota Ibushi. And what happened? He got a spot on the Raw roster anyway. So now we're supposed to believe that one loss here, and this guy's career is over. Why? Why? Why is his career over? Is this a career-ending match? Did I miss a stipulation for this match? I don't know. But he wants TJ Perkins to throw the match tonight. Lay down for me so I can win. Great story. And on the Cruiserweight stuff, I just got to say this. I'm not digging the Cruiserweight stuff so far. I don't know what it is. I was looking forward to this for weeks and weeks and weeks. They built this up. Cruiserweights are coming. The Cruiserweights are coming. And all of this, I don't know what it is. All of the stuff about them that I enjoyed in the Cruiserweight Classic, it just seems to be gone. It just seems to be missing on this show. I mean, the one thing is they're definitely toned down in the ring from what we saw in the Cruiserweight Classic. The whole point of the Cruiserweights is to be different from everything else on the show and not be the same just in micro-sized form, right? Whatever, what, I mean, you can bring TJ Perkins and Brian Kendrick and guys like this. I mean, yeah, they're doing a couple of extra flips here and there, but so what? Kofi fucking Kingston does a truss dive over the ropes every single week. Everybody else on the show is doing dives left and right through the ropes. So, you know, everybody else is Divey Boy Smith here on the show. What separates the Cruiserweights from those guys? We saw a lot of really innovative, really cool, and yes, sometimes dangerous stuff in the Cruiserweight Classic. I'm not saying I want these guys to necessarily go out there and kill themselves, but they could go out there and they can do all the flashy kind of moves that we saw there without killing themselves. They can do that. That's the whole point of the Cruiserweights. Be different from everybody else on the show. And maybe that's part of the problem I've talked about before, about all these other guys on the show that all do the same moves, they all do the same dives, and so now we have Cruiserweights, and guess what? The Cruiserweights don't feel so special because everybody else does the same shit. So, whatever it is, something is missing. I hope they can figure it out, because I was really excited to see these guys on Raw, and already I'm losing interest. And where the hell is Jack Gallagher? I was looking forward to seeing this guy on TV. He was one of the biggest revelations for me in that Cruiserweight Classic. I thought he was supposed to be coming to Raw. He was the one I was looking forward to seeing the most, and he's nowhere to be found. We may have to take, you know, we took Neville off the milk cart. We may have to put Jack Gallagher on there now. Where the hell is he? Then the bottom fell out. Paul Heyman and Brock Lesnar came out. Lesnar versus Goldberg is now official. They announced it for Survivor Series. Not on this show, but on Twitter. The day after this show, they made the announcement. Although, to be fair, given the way this segment ended, maybe it's very possible that they were going to announce it on this show and then just ended up not. Brock got a rousing ovation since he went to school at the University of Minnesota. He also tried out for the Vikings, if you remember. So he's a Minnesota boy. In fact, the last time they came to Minneapolis and Lesnar was on the show, this was, I think, last year, they dropped confetti from the ceiling, and they called it his homecoming celebration. Which begs the question, what did Vince McMahon think was going to happen here? Well, I'll tell you what happened. Paul Heyman tried his hardest to get the crowd to chant Goldberg as a way to piss off Brock Lesnar. But instead, they were met by chants of Suplex City and Goldberg sucks. Heyman found one guy in the crowd chanting Goldberg's name. He pointed directly at him. He tried to pretend like this was part of some kind of like groundswell of support for Gold. Like half the arena or more was chanting for Goldberg. But to no avail. It just was not working. And to cap off this epic fail, they just hit Lesnar's music abruptly to end the segment and they left the ring. And actually, I give them a lot of credit for that, because at least they saw that this thing was dying a death, and they knew enough not to keep him out there any longer, and let's just give him the hook. So, good on them for at least doing that. Supposedly Vince was in the back freaking out, losing his mind. I don't know why. I don't know why, because anybody with, you know, a functioning brain could have said that, hey, this probably isn't a good idea. Maybe we should do a different kind of segment, or maybe not even have Brock on the show. So, I don't know what he was thinking, but this didn't work. And Goldberg, I think, is now in for a rough night in Toronto. I really hadn't given it much thought, but, you know, Brock, he is the hometown, but I don't know what part of Canada he's from. He's not living in Toronto. He's living somewhere else. I don't know what province he's in. I don't know how close to Toronto it is. I don't even think it matters. I think people probably realize that, you know, he lives in Canada now, but, you know, we'll see. I don't know if it was a one-night aberration or the start of something more. We'll see tomorrow night, I guess, because Goldberg is scheduled to be back on Raw. It's not very often I call a segment with Paul Heyman an epic fail, but that's exactly what this was. And it's on Vince. It's on Vince McMahon for not realizing beforehand that this was going to happen. As Andrew said to me on Twitter, an expensive miscalculation by WWE, wasting one of Brock's very few, very rare appearances on this segment here. Main event had Seth Rollins beating Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho in a handicap match when he pinned both of them at the same time. Yes, it was as stupid as it sounds. Also, I call it a handicap match. It was billed as a triple threat match. It was basically a handicap. It was not a triple threat match. Technically it was a triple threat because Jericho could have pinned Owens and Owens could have pinned Jericho, but that's not what it turned out to be. They saved things a little bit at the end after the match was over by having Owens powerbomb Rollins on the apron. He gave him the apron bomb, and Michael Cole, this was weird. Michael Cole said, that move has taken weeks off people's careers. Well, that's a weird way to put it. I guess it's not completely inaccurate, but that was how they ended the show. Can you tell I didn't like this show? I feel like I'm reaching my breaking point here. I really am. I'm slowly but surely reaching my breaking point. I don't like being this negative about a show because it's draining, okay? It drains me of my energy, especially with all the TNA shit that I've got to talk about. But this was just a bad, boring show with at least two segments that were intended to do something that they didn't do. Two misfires. One in the Bayley segment, and then that entire Lesnar segment. On that note, Hell in a Cell is tonight from Boston, Massachusetts. Now, let me mention here, there is going to be a Sound Off Extra going up tonight, a post-pay-per-view review for Hell in a Cell. It will be going up exclusively in the SE Scoops mobile app, and it will be live there for 24 hours. After those 24 hours, so basically all day Monday, late Monday, early Tuesday, it will hit the YouTube channel for everybody to listen to as normal, plus the MP3 download link will be in the video description if you want to download the audio or stream it. So it will be up on YouTube, but it's going to be delayed by 24 hours. If you can't wait and you want to listen to it, and I encourage you to do so, just download the SE Scoops app. You can get it's free. It's a great app. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. If you have an Apple device or an Android device, they have versions of the app in both stores. And you just kind of go in there tonight and you'll see the link to the Sound Off Extra review. It should be pinned to the top once the audio goes live. It's as simple as that. So definitely check it out there in the SE Scoops app. Let's start from the bottom and we'll work our way up. Of course, the Cruiserweights are going to open things up on the pre-show, on the kickoff show. We've got Cedric Alexander, Lince Dorado, and Sin Cara against Drew Gulak, Tony Nese, and Arya Divari. I figure the babyfaces will go over. I don't see any reason for them not to, so I'll give the nod to Cedric, Lince, and Sin Cara. TJ Perkins is going to defend the Cruiserweight Championship against Brian Kendrick. The story going into the match is TJ Perkins going to lay down for Brian Kendrick? Is he going to let him win? I don't think he is, and I think TJ Perkins is going to retain. He is my pick to retain the championship. We have Anderson and Gallows against Enzo and Cass. I'll go with that, Gallows and Anderson, just because it would seem to make sense. Not that that ever stopped them from doing things that don't make sense. But I said this earlier in the Raw review. It doesn't even matter. Who cares? I don't care. I really don't care who wins this match. I'll pick Anderson and Gallows, but don't care. Bayley and Dana Brooke. I think Bayley gets the win. I don't know that I could stomach another Dana Brooke win over Bayley. It's not even the losing that bothers me, because Bayley should be a natural loser who kind of fights and always falls short, and then eventually she goes on a win streak and works her way up to a championship match. I think if they follow the NXT blueprint, it'll work out very well, but just, she's already lost to Dana Brooke once with that botched up finish. I don't need to see her losing twice to Dana Brooke. So hopefully Bayley will get the W. The New Day against Sheamus and Cesaro for the Tag Team Championship. I'm going to go with the New Day. I think they want to get them closer, if not have them break the 478-day record of demolition. They're not there quite yet. I think they're about, a month or two, month and a half maybe away from that. So why end now? They've come this far. I know the New Day to a lot of people has played out, And actually, in the Cesaro-Sheamus thing, it would kind of make sense for them to win the titles and be unwilling tag team partners who are now starting to get it. They're starting to finally gel and become a good team, and so winning the titles would actually kind of make sense. I just don't think the timing is right for it. It's kind of like Ryback, when they put him in a Hell in a Cell match against CM Punk. The guy had a lot of momentum. He was unbeaten. If you were ever going to take a chance on the guy, that would have been the time to do it, but timing wasn't right. CM Punk was on a roll. He was heading into a championship match against The Rock. And so, in that case, probably not the right decision to make. But then again, you know what? I don't know. I mean, CM Punk against The Rock was going to mean a lot more money than any Ryback match would probably at that point. You could have put the title on Ryback, had Punk win it back the next night or the next pay-per-view. You could have gotten that belt back on Punk in time for the Rumble match. But anyway, I don't know how I got off on that. The New Day wins. That's my pick. And then they're billing it as a triple main event. All three matches inside Hell in a Cell. Roman Reigns defending the United States Championship against Rusev. They've been going at it now for a few months. And this hopefully will be the blow-off, because Hell in a Cell should be the big climax for a feud like this. I think Roman Reigns is going to get the win. I don't see them taking that title off of him just yet. So the big dog, as they call him, is my pick. It's interesting how Rusev has been getting more cheers lately than Roman. Not throughout the entire feud. I mean, they actually did that one segment with Rusev's family a few weeks ago. That is an example of a segment unlike the two that I mentioned before that did not work on Raw last week. That segment with Rusev showing us Mama Rusev and Father Rusev and Babushka Rusev and then Roman coming out and getting beaten down, that worked. That actually worked. When that segment was over, he was standing over Roman Reigns and the accolade on the steps. They were booing Rusev. They were chanting Roman's name. So they've kind of gone back and forth in a way. Some weeks the fans are more into Rusev. Some weeks the fans are totally into Roman. I don't know what they'll be like in Boston. I would imagine probably not very kind to Roman. But I do think he gets the win. Kevin Owens against Seth Rollins for the Universal Championship. Chris Jericho, one would think, would factor into this somehow. I don't know if he'll be hiding under the ring, if he'll break into the cage somehow. I'm sure he'll be making his presence felt. And I think Kevin Owens is going to retain the championship. I wouldn't take the title off him just yet. I think it would be too early to do that. So I would keep it on him. He'll retain. That is my prediction. And then we have Sasha Banks and Charlotte for the Women's Championship. Again, they're calling this a triple main event. There's been a lot made of the match order on this show. Mick Foley kind of messed up a couple of weeks ago, and it seemed like either he misspoke or tipped his hat early when he wasn't supposed to, when he said, "I can't wait to see these women headline," and then he kind of walked it back and said, well, I wasn't really talking about the match order here. I don't know what the match order is going to be. Well, it looks like we now know, because according to an item that was posted just a little while ago on PW Insider, Sasha Banks and Charlotte is now scheduled to headline the pay-per-view. So as of this moment, I guess plans can change, but they have it from someone in WWE that the current plan is indeed for Sasha and Charlotte to main event and go on last tonight, and I think that's a great idea. I've been saying that for weeks now, and I'm very happy that they were able to change some minds, because I know there were some stories floating around during the week that everybody on the creative team was in favor of them going on last. Triple H wanted them to go on last, which makes sense because, I mean, Sasha and Charlotte are like two of his NXT kids. I'm sure he wants to see them be very successful. And unfortunately, the one person who was against the idea is the only person that really matters, and that was Vince McMahon. So the question was, would Vince change his mind? If Vince was okay with it, then they would do it. And I guess something must have happened. He must have changed his mind, because the plan now is apparently for Sasha and Charlotte to go on last. And that would be the first time in the history of the company that two women would indeed headline a pay-per-view. Not like an NXT TakeOver show, but an actual pay-per-view event. And that's kind of a big deal. Now, some people might, you know, be against the idea because they didn't hype it, they didn't promote it. I saw some of that talk during the week, and that's complete nonsense. I mean, people, generally speaking, probably don't even care about the match order. This matters to a small number of people. There are a lot of people, some of you probably even listening to this right now, who could not care less what the match order is on the show. But this idea that It should be promoted in advance. Whether the women go on last or not doesn't change a single thing when it comes to people determining if they want to buy the pay-per-view or sub to the network. It makes 0% difference in the decision that they make as far as getting this pay-per-view or starting a network subscription. It will not net them a single buy or a single subscription. It makes no difference. So other than just kind of tooting their own horn and saying, hey, look at what we're doing for the very first time, which they could have done, I guess, if they would have announced this weeks ago. Aside from them kissing their own ass, which they do enough of as it is, I don't see why people would be so bent out of shape about that. You don't have to promote something like that in advance. This was the perfect time to do it. Of all the matches, of all the main events that are being promoted on this show, none has been built up better, in my opinion, than this one. Especially after that contract signing on Monday. I thought, at least the way it was positioned, they really went out of their way to try to make this match feel like a big deal. And there isn't another main event on this show, whether it's Roman and Rusev, which I guess you could say Roman and Rusev has been going on for a lot longer, right? This is not the first time they're wrestling. They've been going at it for months. This is hopefully the culmination of that feud. But whether it's Roman and Rusev or even Rollins and Owens, as much as I like those guys, neither one of those matches are lighting my world on fire. And neither one of those matches have this great burning personal issue where, oh my God, it has to go on last. Unless there's some kind of big cliffhanger or a major return or debut that's planned in the Owens-Rollins match that would necessitate them going on last, they don't have to go on last. You can use a pay-per-view like Hell in a Cell to put the women on last. And there will be people who make this out to be a big deal. The fact that the women for the very first time are going on last. Great. So why not just put them on last? So I think it's really cool that apparently that's what they're going to do. I think it's the right move to make. And especially, you know, Sasha's going into this thing. She's the champion. She's the hometown hero of all the people on this show. Although I guess Kofi. I think Kofi is from Boston, but they don't really promote that. They still promote him as being from Ghana, West Africa. But Sasha Banks is the hometown hero in Boston. And they're rolling into Boston tonight. And so male or female, you know, she's a champ. She's from Boston. Why the hell not let her headline the show? She's probably going to get the biggest reaction out of anybody on the show anyway. And I do think that she's retaining her title. I think Charlotte's pay-per-view undefeated streak of like 12 shows in a row that she's never been beaten, I think it comes to an end tonight. You get the big babyface hometown hero celebration, and Sasha retains her championship. That's my prediction. SmackDown. An actual wrestling show. SmackDown. Show opened with Kane against Bray Wyatt in a no DQ match. I almost fast-forwarded through this. You'll be proud of me that I didn't do it. I stuck with it. Luke Harper was out there to help Wyatt. Actually, you may not be proud of me. You may think, what a dumbass. I fast-forwarded through it. But I watched this. Randy Orton came out. He was setting up for an RKO when instead of hitting one of the Wyatts, he dropped Kane with the RKO. And the Wyatts were shocked. The announcers were shocked. Orton slithered out of the ring. He walked to the back. Bray pinned Kane, got the win. Later in the show, Orton told one of the random female microphone holders, if you can't beat him, join him. So it would appear, at least they want you to think, that Randy Orton has joined the Wyatt family. Now, of course, he really hasn't joined the Wyatt family. It's just a matter of how long they decide to drag this thing out before the big payoff. They tried this once before with Daniel Bryan. They aborted it pretty quick. Although, the payoff with Bryan joining, quote-unquote, joining the Wyatt family, I thought is still to this day one of the all-time great segments in Raw history. That was where he's in the cage. It was some kind of cage match. And after the match, Bray is, you know, again, browbeating him. And he goes to give him the Sister Abigail. And Bryan slips out of it. And it's almost like he's coming out of his trance. Go back and watch that segment and watch the crowd reaction and the way that that whole thing built and built and built. And then when Bryan finally starts fighting back. Oh, my God. I mean, I have very few times in the last many years, I don't even know how many years, have I seen a segment on TV that has gotten that kind of crowd response. I mean, it happens when people come back. If you haven't seen, like, Shane McMahon when he came back, Goldberg. Segments like that, you expect it. I'm talking about a storyline or a match that they do on TV. It was unbelievable. And again, Brian was only part of the Wyatt family for a few weeks. They could have dragged that thing out a lot longer if they wanted to. So we saw that in the Brian Daniel Wyatt stuff. I suspect that we will get something similar here. The thing about that Brian thing, by the way, now that I think about it, it's really too bad that he suffered a concussion. He doesn't remember any of it because that segment was so great. This will all be worth it, though, if we get to see Randy Orton dressed up as a Wyatt. Like, Randy Orton comes out, usually he's wearing his tights, he's got his latest t-shirt, or now it's his latest hoodie that he's advertising, right? Okay, fine. But if they're going to do this, if they're going to drag this for at least a few weeks, you got to go all the way with it. The guy's got to dress up like, oh, I know he doesn't have the facial hair, or too much of it, but he's got to dress up as a Wyatt. Especially because that would mean that Randy Orton would actually have to wear pants on TV. Becky Lynch is back from whatever her medical ailment was. I saw there were some really ridiculous rumors. I don't know where this shit gets started. I would just tell people, just be mindful of where you get your news from. Nobody knows what the medical ailment was. Obviously, it wasn't overly serious because now she's back. She was back for a promo in the ring with Alexa Bliss, who is getting her shot at the title next week. I saw the rumor that the reason Becky Lynch doesn't get a lot of promo time is because Kevin Dunn apparently hates her accent and wants to limit her mic time as much as possible. At least that's the rumor. So I guess, you know, the angry beaver is at it again. Alexa attacked Becky, left her laying, and then Alexa sprayed a yellow streak down Becky's back. I thought Alexa Bliss was awesome here. I have to say that. She had that Baby Trish vibe going on here. I've mentioned that before on the pod. I don't remember where I read it, but supposedly at the Performance Center, there were people who used to call her Baby Trish because she just reminded people a lot of a young Trish Stratus. But, you know, she obviously is a little bit smaller than Trish was. So they would call her Baby Trish. And she sure had the Baby Trish thing going on here. Which is not a bad person to be compared to. I say that as a compliment, not an insult. But I thought she did a hell of a job here. Alexa's great. You know, in the ring, she's perfectly capable. But I'm talking more her personality, her facial expressions, her promo ability. She's got something there. Nikki Bella beat Natalya with John Cena's STF. In a match, a better STF than Cena does, by the way. A match where the winner would become the captain of the women's team for SmackDown next month at Survivor Series. Now, when I first heard this, I was puzzled, given that Becky Lynch is the reigning women's champion on SmackDown. And given that there's only, by my count, 7 women, not counting Maryse, who doesn't wrestle, on the SmackDown women's roster. Eva Marie being included in that. Now, I don't know if Eva Marie's even going to be back for Survivor Series or not. I know she's off filming a movie somewhere. So let's drop that number down to 6 for all intents and purposes. On a team of 5, I believe, right? I would imagine Becky is going to be on that team. Didn't make any sense then. And it still doesn't make any sense why Becky wouldn't be the captain, now that I think about this. But it's going to be Nikki Bella as the team captain. Carmella came out after and attacked her. She left her laying with a Bella Buster. Spirit Squad, they're still around. They got beat by Heath Slater and Rhino in a match for the tag team titles. And then it was AJ Styles against Dean Ambrose in the main event, with James Ellsworth in Dean's corner. Ellsworth begged and pleaded with Ambrose all night, please let me come out to the ring with you and be in your corner. You supported me. I want to throw that support right back at you. And finally, Ambrose, he acquiesced. He said, okay, you can be in my corner. Just don't do anything. Just stay there. I'll let you come out there. I don't want you to get hurt. Unfortunately for Dean, it would backfire on him. Ambrose and Styles, they were having a pretty good match together. AJ gave a basement drop kick through the ropes to Ellsworth, knocked him down. A few minutes later, AJ ended up dumped outside the ring right next to Ellsworth. And Ellsworth saw this. He started to hulk up. James Ellsworth hulked up. And he gave no chin music to a big reaction, laid out AJ Styles, not realizing that he had just gotten Dean Ambrose disqualified in a match where if Ambrose won, he would get a shot at the WWE title. So Ellsworth cost Ambrose a championship match, and that's how they went off the air. Ellsworth was just devastated by what he had done. Ambrose couldn't believe it. I know on Talking Smack after, again, they had Ellsworth on, and he was just completely dejected over what he had done, and I don't know if he's going to want to be my friend anymore, and I deserve it, he should be angry with me. He was very down on himself. Daniel Bryan and Renee Young were literally, they're trying to talk this guy off the ledge. Don't off yourself. It's not your fault. It was like a suicide hotline there on the network. Apparently, the company was very impressed with how Ellsworth's new t-shirt was selling the first, I don't know, 12 hours or so they put it on sale. Apparently, it outsold everything else on the website. And according to PW Insider, I saw they are considering offering Ellsworth a full-time contract. And to that, I say good for him. Now, he will be overexposed very quickly if they keep putting him on TV every week. I said that last week. I would keep him away for a while. I might even just keep him out until the Royal Rumble. Wait until the Rumble, put him in there at number one, give him a shock elimination on Braun Strowman or somebody like that. That's what I would do. But if this guy gets a contract out of all this, I say congrats. Right? You never know how long a run like this might last. Ride that wave until you can ride it no more. That's what I say. And lastly here, the Headbangers are going to be back this Tuesday. They have been invited back to SmackDown. They will have a chance to qualify for the Raw versus SmackDown Tag Teams match at Survivor Series. Hopefully they don't bash somebody else's face open the way they did Rhino the last time they were on the show.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Austin Aries was injured at the NXT show in Fresno on Wednesday. It was Aries and Samoa Joe against No Way Jose and Shinsuke Nakamura. Nakamura caught Aries with a front leg kick right in the mush. And in doing so, he badly messed up Aries' eye. They had to wave the match off. Aries put a picture up on his Twitter, and I don't know which eye injury was more traumatizing, the one on The Walking Dead last Sunday or this one. His eye is completely swollen shut, or at least it was when he posted the photo. Hopefully by now it's a little bit better. But it was completely swollen shut, black and blue. He got stitches underneath the eye. It's just, gnarly. It also means that he and Roderick Strongspot in the Dusty Classic could be in jeopardy, although I suppose they could always find a replacement partner for Roddy. But there's no way he can wrestle with his eye like that. So if it heals quickly, he'll be, you know, good to go, I guess. But if not, I don't see how they can allow him to wrestle with an injury that bad. I mean, the guy looks like an alien. If you look at the photo, take your hand, cover his one good eye, and just look at the bad one. He looks like some sort of alien creature. Alien Aries could be his new name. The greatest man that never lived. Speaking of the Dusty Classic, we got some movement in the brackets this week on NXT. Tommaso Ciampa and Johnny Gargano beat Hoho Loon and Tian Bing, WWE's first ever Chinese recruit, making his NXT debut here on TV. I thought they worked perfectly fine together, Team China did, I guess, if you want to call them that. Gargano and Ciampa will face the Revival, though, in the next round. Aaliyah pinned Billy Kay with a distraction roll-up for the shock pin after Liv Morgan ran down during the match to go after Peyton Royce outside the ring. That distracted Billy and she got rolled up. After the match, Morgan and Aaliyah both got laid out. I said this before, to me, Billy Kay and Peyton Royce are the new Emma and Dana Brooke on this show. But of the two, I'm more impressed by Peyton Royce. I think she's got something there. I like her look. I think she's a good wrestler. Got personality. I know Billy Kay is, missing something there. But Peyton Royce, I've been impressed by. Ty Dillinger beat Noah Patches with the tiebreaker across the knee. After the match, he started cutting a promo on Bobby Roode, but Roode immediately attacked him from behind and gave him a glorious implant DDT on the stage to build to their match in Toronto. Asuka beat Thea Trinidad, making her NXT debut, the former Rosita from TNA. Got some chance of Rosita, in fact, from the crowd. I'm pretty sure she played a Rosebud a bunch of times, but this was her formal debut in WWE. I believe she and Alien Aries are currently dating. Asuka just toyed with her, just played around with her for a while. She submitted her with an armbar. The announcers pointed out that Asuka has been on the roster now for over a year, and is still undefeated. Nobody has been able to beat her. William Regal came out and said that I have scoured the world for your next opponent since you have laid waste to pretty much everybody else in this division. And I want to introduce you to the person that will be challenging you at the next TakeOver show. And up on the video wall, we saw Mickey James, who apparently filmed this from her backyard. Fans pop big for Mickey. It's been almost 7 years. We haven't seen her in 7 years almost in a WWE ring. So, you know what they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Although Mickey was always a fan favorite, even when they were portraying her as Piggy James on SmackDown. Let us not forget that. But I think this should be a lot of fun. I don't want Asuka to ever lose. I'm sure they'll have a great match, but she should absolutely not be losing to, certainly not to Mickey James. Seeing the crowd chant boring during that Bayley segment last Monday, I don't want Asuka to ever get called down to the main roster, let alone lose. Main event was TJ Perkins and Kota Ibushi against Lince Dorado and Mustafa Ali in a first-round match in the Dusty Classic. Real fun match. Ibushi is awesome. We all know that. Perkins and Dorado did a sequence at the beginning of the match that was unlike anything I've seen from either one of them on Raw so far, which again begs the question of why the Cruiserweight stuff is just so much more fun on this show and on the Cruiserweight Classic than it is on Raw. Perkins got the knee bar on Mustafa Ali. He tapped out immediately. Perkins got Ibushi to dab with him at the end of the match, which really, that alone should have necessitated a heel turn with Ibushi turning on this guy, but he didn't. They will face Sanity in the next round, and I know he's not winning. I know the whole thing with Ibushi, they want him to sign a contract, and he won't do it wisely. The more I watch this show, especially on Mondays with the Cruiserweight stuff, I think it is a wise decision on Kota. Can you imagine Kota Ibushi on Raw in these, and now his English isn't great, so I don't know how much he'd be able to do anyway, but can you imagine him in these backstage dramatic segments and some of this bullshit that we've seen with the Cruiserweights on Raw? Is it any wonder why this guy doesn't want to sign a contract? I don't blame him. Stay as far away as possible. He's got a great deal going on right now. They know how great he is. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep asking him back. Now, we know he's not going to win because they're not going to have Perkins, who's already on Raw anyway, and Ibushi win when Ibushi's not signed to a contract and they can't really do too much with him. So I get that. But look at the deal this guy's got. WWE, the biggest company in the world, whenever they feel like, hey, we want to use this guy, they just call on him and he shows up and he gets to participate in the Dusty Classic or a TakeOver show or whatever it may be. And in the meantime, he could continue to work matches in Japan, whatever it is, New Japan, DDT, whatever it is that he's doing, and just having fun and making money and doing his thing. Who could blame him? Who could fault him for that? He's got a great thing going on. But I am going to be very upset if Ibushi gets bounced in the next round against Sanity. I would let this team go to the semis, go to the finals, and then lose. I don't want to see them lose to Sanity next week. Shout out to Dave Meltzer, Mike Johnson of PW Insider, and Ryan Satin over at Pro Wrestling Sheet. They all did a hell of a job with their coverage of the TNA Billy Corgan stuff this week. Best wishes to Dave, whose mother suffered a stroke last Monday. And best wishes to Vince Russo, too. I saw his mother was apparently admitted into hospice care. It's terrible hearing things like that. The war between Billy Corgan and TNA blew up this week. It all went public, all but the actual dollar amounts, which were redacted. But Corgan's suit was unsealed on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, the two sides were in court arguing their cases. Dixie was in the courtroom. Billy was not. His lawyer was there on his behalf. I said I couldn't wait for this thing to be unsealed, and it did not disappoint. Corgan claims, quote, "The company is continuing to flounder and has been taken to the brink of financial collapse under Dixie and all other managers. The company's secured creditors, including Aralux and Anthem, can foreclose at any time." Wow. Well, you know, for years now, and we've heard people who have worked for the company, but, you know, fans. Now, granted, we don't know all the inner workings of everything, but for years, myself, all the fans have been saying Dixie is terrible, and she's a terrible, you know, manager, and she's taking this company under. It's nice to hear this in a legal setting from somebody who has directly worked with her before actually saying that this woman has taken this company to the brink of financial collapse, which only confirms all the things we've heard for years now about Dixie Carter and about the state of TNA. There is a lot to dissect here. So I'm not going to get into every little detail. I don't want to bore everybody with every little detail, and I'll be here for another hour if I do. But there is a lot to get through as far as everything we learned and everything we heard this week from both sides. Now, first things first, you need to follow Nate Raw. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. Or Rau. R-A-U is his last name. Follow him on Twitter. He writes for The Tennessean. He was there in the courtroom live tweeting during the hearing. And I would imagine that he will be back there tomorrow when the chancellor renders her decision on whether or not she is going to give Billy Corgan the injunction that he is seeking. So you can follow Nate on Twitter at TNNateRAU. That is his Twitter handle. He did a hell of a job going through everything for everybody this week. So what we have learned is that Billy Corgan claims TNA's balance sheet shows that the company's debts are nearly 10 times its assets. Billy's lawyer said the company's financial liabilities have increased 52% since June, and their debt is even greater than that. These are not good numbers. Corgan says TNA lied to him about the amount of debt that it was in, and if he had known that it was that high, he never would have invested in the first place. He claims TNA had TV tapings planned for this week, but they have been postponed due to a lack of funds. Those were to be the shows taped from the Hardy compound, since they've already taped TV through the beginning of December. And then I think the Hardy shows, I think they were going to do two shows maybe from Matt's house, and that was going to be the final shows of the year, I guess, heading into the holidays. And they have, in fact, been postponed. According to PW Sheet, Pro Wrestling Sheet, those shows will be taped later in the month. So it's not a case of the Hardys weren't paid and they're, you know, not letting them tape or something like that. They are going to do the tapings. They're just delaying it by a few weeks. Although Corgan does claim that TNA continues to not pay much of its talent, which TNA is blaming on Corgan. They're actually putting the blame on him and his temporary restraining order, which prevents them from conducting business of any kind, including paying people, I guess. Corgan himself has not yet been paid at all. For all the months he's been involved in TNA, and he's been president, and he's been an on-air character, apparently Billy has not been paid one red cent. And neither has Dixie, not since August. Her and her husband have not drawn a paycheck from TNA since the summertime. So TNA is casting Billy Corgan as the villain here, even though he gave them money to survive. Three separate occasions he gave them money. Once in June, again in July, which prevented TNA from being foreclosed on by Aerolux, and again in August, this time with the demand that I want to take over as president. So, and that's what happened. They put a press release out. I think they made a whole big deal about the fact that Billy Corgan was now the new president of TNA, and I think Dixie had moved into the position of chairman. So Billy moved into the position of president, or so he thought, because according to an email that his team discovered that Dixie sent to Anthem, as if we haven't heard enough about frickin' emails this week, Dixie never had any intention of Billy being the president, other than in title only. She was going behind his back, telling other investors in the company, don't worry, he's not really the president, he only thinks he is. I can't imagine why anybody would want to do business with this woman. Corgan says the company is now insolvent. It is unable to pay its debts. TNA says, no, we're not. We are not insolvent because look at all the interest that we have from these other companies, from these other outside entities, whether it's Anthem Sports, Aerolux, WWE. People are interested. They want to buy us. We're not insolvent. It also came out that whatever WWE offered TNA, and they did make at least one offer to TNA, they came back to them months later with a lower offer. They actually reduced their initial offer, possibly after they were given some documentation from TNA that showed that they were in much worse shape than they being WWE, had been led to believe. We don't know the exact reason why. That's just speculation, but that would seem to make the most sense. Kind of reminds me of Shark Tank. When someone comes into the tank with a certain valuation for their company, they get a bunch of offers from some of the sharks, and then in the course of the negotiation, we find out that they've actually lost money, or there was something they didn't tell the sharks initially that gives them pause, and so the sharks either pull their offer or they lower their offers. You can tell I was just watching Shark Tank last night on the DVR, which I was. Best show on TV. So here's the most amazing thing to me to come out of all, and there was a lot of stuff that came out this week, but to me, this is maybe the most amazing thing. Dixie's lawyer, okay, TNA's lawyer, claims that Billy Corgan is not this great savior that he has been made out to be. Billy Corgan is a predatory lender who had only his own self-interest in mind when loaning TNA the money they needed to continue operations. The fact they say that he refuses to accept Anthem. Now, Anthem came out about a week or two ago, if you remember. They put out a press release and said, we are willing to pay back Billy Corgan, I guess, on TNA's behalf. We'll give him his money back. Of course they'll give him his money back with the understanding that he'll walk away. And Billy ain't having none of that. This isn't just about getting his money back. Billy wants to be rid of these people. He wants to help TNA. He's got all these ideas. He's got all these visions. The idea that Billy Corgan would have gotten in bed with these people, that he would have gotten involved with them months ago and given them possibly, we don't know the exact amount, but let's say in the low millions of dollars, or many, many, many tens of thousands of dollars, whatever it is, of his own money, out of his own pocket, just for the hell of it, is completely ridiculous. But this is what they're arguing. He was pumping money into the company because he had his own self in it. He just wanted to take over, and he was power hungry and screw everybody else. You know, by not agreeing to settle this thing and walk away, they say that Corgan has crippled their business because until this is resolved, they can't pay people, they can't sell the company, they legally cannot make any business moves, which is true. He said TNA, the lawyer did, is a valuable international brand. He said this with a straight face. And he said Corgan was basically like a loan shark. So they went all in on this guy and tried to make him out to be the villain in all this. Three different times, Corgan put his own money into TNA at the last minute when their backs were against the wall, when missing their TV tapings, which they came very close to doing multiple times, would have been a breach of all of their television contracts, both here and abroad, internationally, India, UK, they've got a lot of international TV contracts. If they miss even one taping, they are in breach of those contracts. And Billy was there to save their asses. And yet, in court, their lawyer had the gall to say that Billy Corgan did nothing to set up the necessary funding for their September production, for their September tapings. That would have been bound for glory in the tapings that came the week after. That's where Anthem apparently stepped in to fund all of it. But the notion that they would paint this man as selfish for saving their asses three different times and then claim, well, he didn't give us more money in September, is just appalling. It is appalling. He also blamed the recent lawsuits against them, against TNA, that is, on Corgan. He blamed Corgan for that too. He said that his actions and public comments started a panic. Of course, that doesn't explain American Express filing suit against them in July for not paying their bills. Whatever comments that Corgan may have made recently, like he did the Busted Open show, he did a few interviews, but that was in September or early October. What about July? What about not paying your bills back then? So Baghdad Bob Esquire over here also told the judge that the tax lien against TNA by the state of Tennessee was, in his words, an accounting mistake. He called it a non-issue. Nothing to see here. Meanwhile, Bruce Pritchard told a story on his podcast about when he worked for TNA in talent relations. TNA took withholding from his paycheck that was supposed to go to the IRS and never paid the government. So the IRS came after him for $10,000. But this tax lien, oh well, you know, this is just a simple accounting mistake. Happens to everybody. Corgan says Dixie, nor anybody else in management at TNA ever told him about their negotiations with WWE. And even worse, he claims they lied to him when the subject came up in late September. The company's CFO, this Dean Broadhead guy, denied to Corgan that they were selling to WWE or even talking to WWE, but it came out that the day before that denial, Broadhead sent WWE some due diligence documents that they had requested from TNA the day before. So they lied to Corgan to conceal the fact that they were actively negotiating with WWE. Dixie says, no, no, no. Corgan barely showed up to the office. He wouldn't involve any of us in any of his meetings. And allegedly, she claims that he said, you know, you're damaged goods, Dixie. I don't intend to involve you. And by the way, if that last part is true, he wouldn't be wrong in saying that. Remember that talent meeting that Dixie called at the Impact tapings after Bound for Glory? PW Insider had a whole write-up on what she allegedly told the talent, one thing being that she admitted that WWE was interested in buying the company, but that I would never allow that to happen. That's what she told them. She said this, even as it now comes out that she had actively been in talks with WWE, not only then, but going back to at least June of this year, and probably even earlier than that. And then later, in an email to WWE, where WWE, they were concerned about, you know, Billy Corgan's involvement and the money that's owed to him and all that. And she told WWE that she planned to pay Corgan back his money with interest, essentially just to kind of get him out of the equation, were a sale to actually move forward with WWE. That's why they lied to Corgan about it. So to say that I would never let WWE buy the company, that too was a lie. And in that same meeting, she also told the talent the pay-per-view, remember Bound for Glory? There was a lot of talk. Is it even going to happen? She told the talent it was never not going to happen. We did have to scramble. That was her word. We had to scramble to make it happen. The only thing scrambled here is this woman's brains. What does that even mean? If you had to scramble, then obviously the pay-per-view must have been in some kind of jeopardy of not happening. I bring this up because in the TNA response to Corgan's filing, Dixie blames Corgan for not coming through again with that fourth round of funding in September. Right? And at near midnight, on the eve of the deadline to keep the production trucks rolling for Bound for Glory, she was able to strike a deal with Anthem to save the tapings. So clearly, none of those shows would have happened had they not gotten that last-minute funding from Anthem, so that was yet another lie that they weren't in jeopardy. Of course they were. Now, at least there, I can understand her not wanting to panic everybody, but still, there is a clear pattern of deceit with this woman. She might be a better wrestling promoter than we've been giving her credit for. But there is a clear pattern here with this woman. Now, here's where things get a little hairy for Billy Corgan. One of the arguments made in court by TNA's lawyer is that the contract that was entered into between Corgan and Dixie, because apparently that last time he loaned Dixie the money personally. So whatever agreement, the contract that they reached, the one where he said, okay, I'll give you the money, but I want to become president. And if you default or you don't pay me the money back, then I get your 92.5% share in the company. That whole agreement that they had, according to the TNA lawyer, is illegal under Tennessee state law, which means that even if Billy is right and TNA is insolvent, if they're deemed to be insolvent, he still would not be entitled to taking full power because what he entered into was an illegal contract. It would be null and void. On that note, I got a message from one of our longtime listeners, Justin, who has a friend who works as a trial lawyer in the state of Tennessee. This is her understanding of the situation. I put this up on Twitter and Facebook, but I'll read it real quick here too. This is her understanding of the situation, and it doesn't sound good for Billy. She said, both property and title pledge agreements are covered under Tennessee Title Pledge Act. Tennessee law forbids anyone from engaging in the business of title pledging without first obtaining the requisite business licenses within the state. Additionally, pledge agreements made by an entity who does not have such a license is void and unenforceable. And the person making the loan forfeits the right to collect any monies in connection with the title pledge agreement. And then she gives the Tennessee code number. I pulled the Tennessee list of approved pledge lenders and Billy's name is not on there. The only way Corgan could win on this argument is if he could show that Carter fraudulently induced him to sign the contract, but he or his attorney had a duty to know that they could not act as pledge lenders. TNA could also countersue Corgan for making a pledge loan, and if they win, he could be out every bit of the money he loaned them. Since Corgan said he loaned the money, but only under those circumstances, that being stakes in the company, position of president, he is screwed. He really has no excuse for not knowing that you cannot loan with a pledge agreement without a license. So, that's not good. That's not good. Now, keep in mind, this is based strictly on the lawyer's understanding of the agreement between Billy and Dixie. She doesn't have all the details. She's just going by what she heard or what she was told about this case. If Dixie committed fraud here, if she knowingly entered into a fraudulent deal with this man, I guess they'd have to prove that, so the onus may be on Corgan to prove it, but she may need to be worried about more than just losing her company. I'm not saying we're going to see Dixie in an orange jumpsuit sharing a cell with Nails, but this whole situation sounds so shady. So shady. In the end, here's the sum it all up, okay? In the end, there are no real winners here. If Corgan wins and he gets control of the company, it's still a company that is mired in millions of dollars in debt, with no real way to make money. Even if they somehow get rid of all the debt, how are they going to make money? How is TNA suddenly going to make money? You know what I mean? So that's one potential outcome. Now, if Corgan loses, he could be out millions of dollars, depending on how much he loaned them and if he could even get any of that money back. Now, if somehow Dixie can get Corgan out of the way and just sell everything to WWE, and I don't know how likely that is, given that you have other stakeholders in the company, then she could at least walk away with some money, but those debts would still have to be paid, I mean, unless they file for bankruptcy, which I guess is another possibility. Best case scenario here is Corgan wants this. If he wants it, then Corgan gets the injunction, which means that Dixie and all them can't make any moves. He essentially would end up taking over the company, most likely. Dixie is forced out, and Billy is free to do with the company whatever he wants. But somehow, this woman always manages to find a way out of these situations. I feel like this is going to be no different. She's going to find her way out of it again. Lady Luck is going to be riding on her shoulder. We'll find out tomorrow what the judge, or the chancellor, I guess she is, we'll find out what her ruling is. The ruling is going to be whether or not Corgan's restraining order, which is preventing them from doing anything right now, it's basically paralyzed TNA from making any moves until this gets resolved. Her decision will be whether or not that restraining order becomes an injunction, in which case Dixie and Aralux and all of them, they can't make any moves without Billy's consent. If she rules against an injunction, then Dixie can make whatever move she wants to make. I guess that includes possibly selling the company. So it's going to be an interesting day tomorrow, either way. That is for sure. And on Halloween, of all days. How appropriate. We'll see if Dixie rides in on her broomstick. Lucha Underground. We had Sexy Star opening the show, barging into Dario Cueto's office to demand a match with the Monster Matanza next week for the Lucha Underground title. Oh, God. Ugh. Dario says, sure, but, you know, you gotta defend your Gift of the Gods title first tonight against Johnny Mundo. So, if you get past Johnny, you can get a title match with my brother. Marty the Moth beat Ivelisse in a match that didn't bother me as much as the main event did. After the match, Marty and Mariposa, they're beating Ivelisse down. Out comes Evie's new boyfriend, Jeremiah. Sami Callihan came out to make the save, despite the fact that Ivelisse had previously told him that she did not want their relationship to have anything to do with the temple or Lucha Underground. She wanted to have a completely separate relationship, separate and apart from all that, and yet here this guy is coming to her aid. And later on, we found out that Dario offered him the chance to compete in the temple, and he accepted. Dario met with Lorenzo Lamas, or I guess Councilman Delgado, in a limousine. He tells Dario his dissension is now complete. Who he is, we're not told, but I assume it's probably that Dr. Claw-looking dude we saw with them in the limo a few weeks ago. Soon the gods will be reunited and nobody can stop us, Dario says. And the councilman asks, have you chosen the next host body? See, this shit's getting weird now. So Dario says, well, I've got two bodies in mind, which I'm guessing is probably either Cage or Tejano, who have been battling in that Best of Five series for some sort of unique opportunity. And I think we may now know what that unique opportunity is. So the councilman hands Dario a trunk of some kind with something inside. We don't know what. If it's a soul, who knows? I'm still wondering what was in the briefcase from Pulp Fiction when John Travolta opened it. You saw the orange glow, the yellow glow in his face. I don't know if it was gold bars of bullion or what it was. I'm still wondering. So he gives Dario the trunk, and off he goes back into the temple. So this is actually the perfect episode to be recapping here on our Halloween show, I have to say. Speaking of which, Tejano and Cage, match 3 in their best of 5 series. Cage is up 2-0, so Tejano has some ground to make up here. This is probably the best match of the series so far. These guys, they work well together. They had a good match. Buckle bomb and an F5 by Cage, only get to 2 count. And Tejano then got a small package for the win. Not a big fan of that finish, but Cage is now up 2-1 in the series. Rey Mysterio comes to Dario's office to request a loser leaves lucha match against Chavo Guerrero next week. He says he's tired of dealing with Chavo's bullshit, and sometimes you've got to put a dog down for its own good. Johnny Mundo and Sexy Star for the Gift of the Gods title. I did not like this match at all. I thought it was sloppy. I thought there were a bunch of jump cuts. You can clearly tell there was some editing done to this thing. Sexy Star sometimes moves like she's in quicksand. Not Eva Marie. Not at that level. Not Eva Marie slow, but close enough. Just to set up some of her moves, because the guy has to work with her, and it's just very, I don't know, it's very contrived sometimes. I just didn't think this was any good. Johnny tried. He tried his best, but I didn't think this was any good. And then came all the smoke and mirrors. We had multiple ref bumps. We had outside interference. We had weapons. It felt like a Jeff Jarrett TNA main event. And that's not meant as a compliment. The Worldwide Underground got involved, which is to be expected. They always are there to help out Mundo. Phoenix, Drago, and Aerostar were banned from ringside earlier by Dario, but the Mac showed up to help Sexy even the odds a little bit. It was just an overbooked mess, you know, and sometimes an overbooked mess can be fine. Sometimes an overbooked mess can be really exciting, and this was not one of those times. The only good thing to come out of this is that Johnny Mundo got the win. He used brass knucks, he knocked her out, and he pinned her. So Johnny Mundo is the new Gift of the Gods champion, and hopefully that keeps Sexy Star far away from Matanza, unless she ends up in that Aztec Warfare match in a few weeks. But as main events go, I give this a thumbs down. One of the few times you will ever hear me giving anything on Lucha Underground a thumbs down. Show ended with Vampiro backstage telling Prince Puma how much he's always respected him, even though he and Puma's former mentor Conan never did get along. He hated Conan, but he always respected Puma. Clearly, Vampiro is setting this guy up for doom at some point. And that was the show. So, with that out of the way, let's get to your questions. This week's Magic Mailbag is sponsored by Pro Wrestling Magic. Their next big event, Final Hours, The Road to Kingdom Come, takes place Saturday, November 19th at New Milford High School in New Milford, New Jersey. Special start time of 4 p.m. We have Sonya Strong defending her women's championship against Kimber Lee. Limitless Keith Lee makes his return. The ultra-violent beast Masada makes his debut. Plus the Beaver Boys, JT Dunn, and many more. A portion of the proceeds will go to the Children's Cancer Institute for Pediatric Cancer Research. Tickets can be purchased at prowrestlingmagic.ticketleap.com. And you can use the promo code SOLOMONSTER to save $3 off your ticket. It's $30 for a front row seat, $20 for general admission. But for either one, use the code SOLOMONSTER, get yourself $3 off, and enjoy a good night of independent pro wrestling. Shout out to Great North Wrestling. Their Star Stampede event is coming up on Saturday, November 5th in Hawkesbury, Ontario. Former Pro Wrestling Noah star, The Prodigy, Nathan Banner, will be wrestling Wes Briscoe on that show. I interviewed Nathan here. If you're a longtime Sound Off fan, here's some trivia for you. I interviewed Nathan on the podcast way back when on episode 187, same show where I interviewed Jay Lethal. So as Nathan continues on his voyage here and becomes a big star, I like to think I get a little bit of credit for that, you know. Why not? But no, really, ticketweb.ca is the place to go if you want to purchase tickets. Go see Nathan. Go support Nathan. If you have questions for the mailbag, as always, you can send them to thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Mark, from Reading, Pennsylvania. What are your thoughts on the Obama administration calling on states to ban the use of non-compete agreements? Could this have a big effect on WWE? I saw that story. Basically, Obama wants each state to ban the use of non-compete agreements because they feel, you know, it would spur more competition. It would help protect some of the lower wage earners. Their argument is that you have a lot of low wage earners out there who don't make a lot of money. And let's say they get fired and their employer enforces a non-compete. It makes it harder for those people to go out and find a job. Apparently, and I didn't know this, but apparently you've got like sandwich shops, like a, I don't know if Subway in particular, but places like a Subway, like fast food joints, in some cases will have employees sign a non-compete so that if they get fired or they leave for a certain amount of time, I guess they can't go work, let's say for like a Burger King or a McDonald's or like another one that's within a 5 mile radius. I mean, I heard that. I was like, are you kidding me? That's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. And this goes on quite a bit, apparently, and they're trying to, what they're trying to do with this is to cut back on that kind of thing. I agree with them on that. I think there ought to be restrictions on certain types of non-compete agreements, but I don't agree with just banning them outright. I do think you put more restrictions in place to stop them from happening. Like in situations like that, I just find that to be completely ridiculous, but I don't think you do away with it altogether. Like I'll give you an example. I've signed a non-compete agreement before for jobs in the past. I've been required to sign a non-compete. In my case, it wasn't, well, if you leave or, you know, if your employment is terminated, you can't go work for another firm for a period of X weeks or X months. Or you can't work for another firm anywhere in all of Manhattan. Like, it was nothing like that. It was an agreement that for a period of, I want to say maybe it was a year, after leaving, if I were to leave, I couldn't take clients that I had worked with away from my old firm and bring them with me to my new firm. And that, I think, is a perfectly reasonable thing to ask. I think something like that is fine. Now, how this might affect WWE, I really don't know, because WWE is not your typical business, right? If McDonald's, like I was saying before, if McDonald's wants its employees to sign a non-compete that says if they get fired, you can't go work for Burger King or Wendy's, that's different. That's stupid, and that should be done away with. Now, with WWE, their performers, they're not even considered employees. They're considered independent contractors, right? That whole farce. So, for all I know, they may be exempt from something like this, but I hope they're not. I would like to see this non-compete stuff become a thing of the past in pro wrestling. There's also the issue of how enforceable these things, like these agreements really are in court. Would they, you know, if they were even challenged in court, would they hold up? I really don't know how this would apply specifically to WWE because it is such a unique business, but if this were to actually happen, then they should be required to follow the law just like everybody else, and these agreements should become a thing of the past. And if that means that someone like Dolph Ziggler gets fired or he doesn't re-sign or whatever, and let's say normally he couldn't go wrestle somewhere else for 90 days, no, do away with that. Let him show up next week on TNA or Ring of Honor. Why not? Why not? I don't see anything wrong with that. Why should he be forced to sit at home and just wait until the agreement runs out? What, you know, I mean, it's like, I'm trying to think of this in layman's terms. If you have a guy like Dolph Ziggler, Dolph Ziggler made his name in WWE. He's been there forever. This guy has been there forever. He's gone through so many different gimmicks. He's been Dolph Ziggler for like a decade now, okay? So whatever notoriety and fame he has is absolutely due to his time in WWE. So on the one hand, I guess the argument is, well, this guy made his name in WWE. He's the Intercontinental Champ. Like, he's doing stuff now on TV. And let's say he gets fired or whatever happens. Why should he be allowed to kind of benefit from that fame or whatever the storyline was that he was involved in? Let's say he was feuding with AJ. He was just coming out of a main event feud on SmackDown. Why should he be allowed to show up the next week on Ring of Honor TV? Well, I think about it in terms of me. If I'm working at a firm and I'm a vice president, I've worked there my entire life. I've been there 10, 15 years. I learn everything I know from my boss and the people I work with. And I made my way up from just a basic worker up to an executive position. And I get a better position at another firm. And I want to go work there. And they tell me, well, you know, they're not going to say to me, you can't go work there for 3 months. Under normal circumstances, within a month or a few weeks or whatever, I'm going to go work at the other firm. Right? They're not going to tell me I can't go work there for 3 months. But I'm going to the other firm because they hired me based off the experience I got working for this other company. They only hired me because I was doing such a good job over here. Right? But I could start with them probably the next week or 2 weeks later, whatever. So why should pro wrestling be any different? So Dolph Ziggler, you know, he became a big star and he got all this experience in WWE and now somebody else wants to take him. So what? Let him take him. Why can't he show up on TV the next week? Or how is that harming WWE? So my take on it is I would be completely fine with it if they got rid of this non-compete BS in pro wrestling. Alan, writing all the way from Zimbabwe. Yeah, we got people listening from all over the world. How do you think WWE will present the Money in the Bank pay-per-view in this new brand split era? Could they make it a big pay-per-view number 5, along with WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam, and Survivor Series, featuring both SmackDown and Raw rosters, leading up to a brand versus brand ladder match for the briefcase, with the winner getting to cash in on their respective brand's champion? Or could we see them bringing back 2 Money in the Bank ladder matches, 1 for each brand? Well, when the brand split started, I said that Survivor Series was not one really considered by a lot of people to be one of the big 4 shows anymore. I don't consider Survivor Series to be one of the big 4. Now, they're making an effort to make it more special. They got Goldberg against Brock, and we'll see what else they do. It'll be Raw versus SmackDown. That should make it feel more special. But for years now, Survivor Series hasn't been really anything special. Money in the Bank, to me, is really one of the big 4. And so what I would do, I don't even know that I would have had Survivor Series as one of the big 4, but I would make Money in the Bank a joint brand pay-per-view. And I kind of like your idea of having a Money in the Bank ladder match that has both Raw and SmackDown guys in it. Now, it would have to be an even number, so if it's, let's say, 8, you get 4 and 4. 10, I think, would just be too many. So you're probably looking at 3 and 3 or 4 and 4. And they're both battling one another, and whoever wins gets to cash in on their respective brand's championship. It's kind of like the Royal Rumble. They're going to have a mix of Raw and SmackDown guys, 15 and 15, or maybe not. Maybe they'll have some surprises, and it'll actually be, I don't know. Whatever the equal number of Raw and SmackDown guys are, the winner of the Rumble gets a main event championship match at WrestleMania against their respective brand's champion. That's how it's going to work. So I think Money in the Bank should work the same way, but I also think that Money in the Bank should already be one of the big 4. You want to make it the big 5? I'd be okay with that. I don't need to see multiple Money in the Bank matches. We don't need to... One is fine. Again, less is more. I see that Survivor Series this year now is going to be 4 hours. I'm sure the Royal Rumble will be 4 hours as well. You wait. They'll make the announcement too that Royal Rumble will end up being 4 hours. But less is more. These shows don't all have to be supersized. WrestleMania, I get it. You want WrestleMania to be long? It's the biggest show of the year? Fine. No problem. Does Survivor Series really need to be 4 hours? Somebody said to me, well, that means that Goldberg and Lesnar will get plenty of time. How much time does Goldberg Brock Lesnar need? I said this match should not go long. This match should be 10 minutes from bell to bell. Between the video package and the entrances alone, plus a 10-minute match, you'll kill half an hour right there. How long does this freaking match need to be? You really want Goldberg going in there wrestling a 15, 20-minute match? Now, they'll have a bunch of Survivor Series matches, but I'm just looking at the people that who should and could be in those matches. You're probably going to have most of the champions in these Survivor Series matches. So, again, how are you going to fill these 4 hours, and then even if they find a way to fill the 4 hours. Look, I was in Brooklyn for summer. I was at Mania, and I was at SummerSlam, both of which were 4 hour shows. And SummerSlam was just, they kept pushing that show up and up. And we had our meetup at a bar a few blocks away. I was still there hanging out with people, and people were like, oh, the show already started. And I was like, oh, okay, well, it was like 5:30, and they're like, oh, the show started. I'm like, how freaking early do these shows have to start? So now they're doing it with Survivor Series, and I've just always been a big believer that less is more. You don't have to Again, you don't have to supersize everything to make it better. If anything, it's just going to make it worse. Most of the people in that building at the Barclays Center in August were dead tired by the time that show was over. It's like 3 hours of Raw, 4 hour pay-per-views. There was a pay-per-view a few months ago. It's like 11:15, still going. Now, they're free to do that on their own network, but it's like, it's like, if they were putting out a compelling product that we just could not get enough of, that would be one thing. But it's not. It's just the opposite. But they keep pumping out more and more. 3 hour Raws, 4 hour pay-per-views, 2 hour pre-shows. At what point do we say enough is enough? Menge writes in, I was thinking WWE should turn Bayley heel on Sunday by attacking both Charlotte and Sasha after their match is over and then have her lift the women's title up in the air. What do you think of that idea? I love you, buddy, but I think that's a terrible idea. And, but then again, they got them to chant boring during a Bayley segment, and I never thought I'd see that. So there really is no limit to what terrible ideas they might come up with. Turning Bayley heel right now would certainly be way up there. James from Spokane. I was watching back when the Million Dollar Man was walking into the jewelry store to pick up the Million Dollar Belt. First, why in the hell was he wearing a cape? Also, don't you think that DiBiase's voice would have been a great cartoon villain voice with his laugh? And was he in the wrong era, or do you think he could still put that character, or make that character something today? Well, I mean, we'll start from the beginning here. I have no idea why he wore that cape, just like I have no idea why Kane wore a cape for his first few matches in WWE. But it's funny as hell, watching him walk into that jewelry shop and just scare the shit out of everybody when he comes in screaming, I'm here! Right? He just yells, like, I'm here! And there was a missed opportunity there with Vampire DiBiase, I think. On the cartoon thing, I agree. His voice reminds me a little bit of James Avery's voice on the old Ninja Turtles cartoon. He was the voice of Shredder. James Avery, by the way, was also Uncle Phil on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I think DiBiase with that voice could have played Shredder on that cartoon. And was he in the wrong era? Absolutely not. He was in the perfect era for that character. Are you kidding me? That was when WWE had all those over-the-top gimmicks and DiBiase fit right. And look at the outfit he used to wear. I mean, that's not over the top. I don't know what is. So he fit right in there. Now, could he make that character work today? Look, I think he had the talent to make it work. But the Million Dollar Man today, the way things are now, there is no way they would ever let him humiliate kids on TV, kick the basketball away, make them cry. He'd have a Twitter. He'd post pictures of his family and his kids to the point where it's like, how could I hate this guy? And he'd have to walk around with that pink ribbon on his shirt like all the other heels. I'm perfectly content keeping the Million Dollar Man back in the 80s, in the early 90s, where he belongs. It just would not be the same today. Juan from Santa Rosa, California. What are your thoughts on an all-women's pay-per-view on the WWE Network, the NXT, Raw, and SmackDown Women's Champion against each brand's number one contenders? The remainder of the card would be a Queen of the Ring-style tournament where the winner faces their brand's champion at the next brand's pay-per-view or takeover special. I'm not really a fan. Not really a fan. We've already got 19 pay-per-views on the network. This goes back to what I said before. I was talking about less is more. We have 3-hour Raws and 4-hour pay-per-views and 2-hour pre-shows. We have 19 pay-per-views on the docket, on the schedule now, coming up this year. Do we really need another one? A Queen of the Ring tournament, I think I'd be okay with. You know, Raw versus SmackDown, I would leave NXT out of it. And as far as why, look, Asuka is the Queen Bee over at NXT. She's been undefeated for over a year. You put Asuka in that tournament, she has to win. If Asuka's going to be in a Queen of the Ring tournament with Raw and SmackDown women and not win, the whole thing is completely stupid. So, and just the idea that you're going to have NXT, which I know NXT is the third brand, it's still developmental. So are you really going to have developmental talents just beating Raw and SmackDown people? If that's the case, then why the hell are they in NXT? It just doesn't make sense. So I would keep NXT out of it. You could do Raw and SmackDown, the best women from each show, and like you said, Queen of the Ring. I don't even know why. I don't really like that name. I would come up with a different name for it, maybe. But I would be okay with that idea. You could have each brand could host their own early round matches, and then maybe on a, let's say on a joint pay-per-view, like a SummerSlam or a Survivor Series, you could do the semi-final round matches and do the finals, you know, Raw against SmackDown. I think that could work. Andy from Houston, Texas, with Halloween this Monday. Now, let me just say we have a bunch of Halloween questions here. This is a Halloween-themed episode of the Sound Off, so we got a couple of questions that are Halloween and horror movie-themed. So Andy sent one, and he says, with Halloween this Monday, what are your favorite horror movies? Which is a loaded question. Halloween is my favorite. I got this question. I jotted a whole bunch of things down on here, but I don't need to jot this down. I can tell you right off the bat, the original Halloween movie from 1978, that is my favorite horror movie. Halloween 3, I have grown to love. I was one of those people who hated the idea, who just hated it all those years ago. It's not Michael Myers. Why are they calling it a Halloween movie? Until I sat down and I watched it, and then I was like, wow. On its own, this is a really good horror movie. Creepy, the vibe, the music. I just liked it. So Halloween, Halloween 3. For the rest of the ones, these are the ones I jotted down here that I like, that I love, that popped into my head. If I had to make a list of favorites, and this is in no particular order. Alien. How could you do a list like this and not have Alien on there? The Thing. The one that Carpenter did in, I think, 82. A lot of these movies they've rebooted. They've reimagined. There was like another Thing that came out a few years ago that apparently sucked. I didn't see it, but that, you know, didn't get very good reviews. Fright Night is another one I think they redid. I'm talking about, like, I don't even know if they were the originals, but like the ones from the 80s. So, The Thing, Fright Night from the 80s, They Live with Roddy Piper, one of the greatest fight scenes of all time with him and Keith, what the hell is his name? I forgot his name. Anyway, They Live is on my list. Creepshow, Stephen King. It's like four different stories or five different stories in one. You had Ted Danson and Leslie Nielsen and... in the first one, which is one of the only times I've ever seen Leslie Nielsen in like a serious acting role and not doing something for comedy. And then they had Stephen King himself was in one of the stories on there where he turns into like a giant plant or whatever and blows his brains out. Sorry for the spoiler. Then there's one with like a monster under the steps. I just love going from one story to the next. The only story I don't like, and I actually try not to watch it whenever I see Creepshow on TV, I kind of tap out, is the last one, which involves a scientist and a bunch of cockroaches, and I'm not into that. But Creepshow, I love. Cloverfield, and I know some people are going to disagree with me. They're going to be like, are you out of your freaking mind? How can you put Cloverfield on any list of great horror movies? I'm putting it on there. You don't like it? Too bad. It's on the list. And I will throw in a little film. I wrote this one down too, and I don't know if this would be considered horror. This probably would be more sci-fi or thriller than it would be horror, but I'm putting it on there anyway, because if anybody isn't aware of it, you ought to go seek it out. Is called The Andromeda Strain, which I think might be based off a book, but I saw the movie. It was made in the early 70s, which actually makes three films on my list that were made in the 70s. That's a really good one too, so if you've never seen it, find it. The Andromeda Strain. LaDon, which scary movie killer was the most over, meaning he would sell out arenas and merch? Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th, Freddy Krueger from Nightmare on Elm Street, Michael Myers from Halloween, Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or Chucky from Child's Play? Well, I grew up a Jason fan, and not just because of his awesome name. But then later on, I actually became a bigger fan of Michael Myers. I was never really into Freddy. I was always into Jason and then Michael. And I've seen a lot of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, but I was never like a Freddy guy. So then I became a big fan of Michael Myers. I don't know that Michael would be much of a draw, I will admit, if that's kind of the context we're putting this in here. I would go with Jason as a draw. He's got like the hockey mask and the hatchet, and he just looks like a giant badass. You know, people want to see those super violent kills, which is never really what Halloween was about. So I would, if I had to rank them, I would go Jason, Michael, Freddy, Chucky, and then Leatherface. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre scarred me the first time I ever saw it, like the original. But Leatherface never really did anything for me. And it's funny, too, because I never saw the... And this is a pattern with me, and I don't know why this is. I didn't see the original until much later on. And since then, they've made like a gazillion remakes of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The first Chainsaw movie I ever saw was one that they did in the mid-90s. This was in the mid-90s with Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey was in a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, for those of you who don't know and you're sick and tired of seeing him in all those stupid car commercials. And I thought that was an effed up movie. That was one of those things where I'm in bed at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I have all these premium cable channels that I probably don't need. I'm flipping around and I stumble upon this movie. And I'll tell you something. I have come across a lot of movies in my day that I didn't even know or I had never seen that I suddenly became fans of just by flipping around at 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning, in the dark, in the quiet. And that was one of them. I don't know if I'd call it a favorite, but it was pretty messed up. But I didn't know how messed up the Texas Chainsaw movies could be until I saw the first one. And that was just creepy as all hell. But what I was saying is there's like this pattern with me, and I don't know why this is, of where instead of seeing the original or seeing the first of something, I usually see the second one. Or I see one of the later ones first. Even like True Detective, I still have people telling me, you gotta watch season one of True Detective. I started with season two, which a lot of people seem to not like. I thought it was okay. That was the one with Vince Vaughn. You know, I thought it was okay, but everyone like universally is like, forget that. Like, bleach your brain, forget you ever saw that. You got to go watch the first one. And it's the same thing with a lot of movies. I saw, like I said, the Chainsaw movie like 20 years after the original, which wasn't as good as the original. I'm trying to think of some... Oh, Escape from New York. There's another cult classic movie, right, with Kurt Russell. Well, I never saw Escape from New York. I saw Escape from L.A., which was a sequel they did like, I don't know, 12, 15 years later. It came like in the mid-90s, late 90s. They came out with Escape from L.A. And a lot of people pan it and they say it's a terrible movie. Well, I saw that movie first and I kind of like it. I went back later on. I saw Escape from New York and I was like, okay, I can see why people like it, but I still like Escape from L.A. I don't apologize for it. And this has happened a whole bunch of times with like a bunch of different movies. So I don't know. Can't explain it. I don't know why. But anyway, that's how I would rank all of the horror movie villains. I gotta give the number one spot to Jason. Kevin from Victorville, California. I know you're a huge fan of horror movies, preferably the Halloween films. So here is a buy or sell for you. Buy or sell. On which version of the Halloween movies you like more, the Laurie Strode timeline, which is Halloween, Halloween 2, Halloween H2O, and Halloween Resurrection, or the Jamie Lloyd timeline, Halloween, Halloween 2, Halloween 4, 5, and 6. You know, I like them both, but I how can I sell on Jamie Lee Curtis? That's the original. How can I sell on that? I got to buy on Laurie Strode. I'll sell on Jamie Lloyd. Even though I did enjoy part 4, I thought part 5 was okay. Wasn't really that good. Part 6, I have no use for. It wasn't even Danielle Harris playing the character by that point. I'm a big Danielle Harris fan. You guys already know that. I know I've mentioned that on the podcast before. When she did those Hatchet movies, I want to say it was the second one. They had a live screening at a movie theater in Times Square. And she was there doing Q&A after the movie. And I went to that. She was awesome. She's just a cool person. I enjoy her films, but just when you listen to her speak and whatever, she's just like a normal person, you know? So for those who don't know anything about the Halloween movies, the original is still the best. It's the greatest horror film ever made, as far as I'm concerned. Practically no blood. No gore, guts, blood in the entire movie. And it's still the best. Michael Myers as a kid, one night Halloween night, out of nowhere, murders his sister. And what I love about it is that there's never any explanation for why he did what he did. He's like a six-year-old kid, and just one night, he snaps, and he does it. He murders his sister. And that's what makes it so unnerving. They don't just come out and tell you, oh, this is why it happened. You never really know why. And it's a kid. So years go by, he escapes the mental hospital that he's in. He finds his way back home to a small town in Illinois. Jamie Lee Curtis is Michael's sister. Although we don't know that until the second film. So at no point in the original Halloween is any sort of connection made that this girl is in any way related to Michael Myers. It just so happens that I think her father is like a realtor and they're selling the old house that Michael used to live in and killed his sister in the night that she died. That's a very loose connection there. So we don't find out until the second film that there's any sort of relationship. And it was never even John Carpenter's plan for her to even be the sister. It became the story of the second film. He didn't even want to do it. He didn't even want to do another Michael Myers film. But the first one did so well, and people wanted more Michael Myers, so he got talked into doing it. They paid him a bunch of money, I'm sure, and he did it. And his plan, and his co-producer or whatever, their plan was to do a new Halloween theme. It would have the Halloween name, but do a new Halloween film each year with its own standalone story. Not to bring back Michael Myers for every single film, but people didn't like that very much. And that third movie, which had nothing to do with Michael, gets a lot of shit. But you know what? Again, I love that movie. I've grown to love it. And I think if people gave it a chance, they would too. Come on. Go watch that Silver Shamrock commercial in that movie. And tell me that you can get that stuff out of your head. So that first movie, that first Halloween movie, which came out in like 78, made $50 million. It made something like $50 million. On a budget of I remember watching a documentary. It made that on a budget of under $500,000. And it wasn't even that much. It was an independent film. So you can see why they would go back to him and say, hey, we want you to make another one. Anyway, long story short, Michael's doctor pursues him throughout most of the films. Donald Pleasance was fantastic in the role of Dr. Loomis. Even after Jamie Lee Curtis's story ended and she left the series and Danielle Harris joined as her daughter. So that was the role that Danielle Harris played in the series. Once Jamie Lee Curtis was gone, she had a conflict. She couldn't film. She kind of took over as Jamie Lloyd. She was her daughter. And that was in the fourth film because people rejected the third one. So part four, let's bring back Michael Myers, and that's kind of where Danielle Harris came from, and the story is that Laurie and her husband had died in a car accident, and now her daughter Jamie was adopted by another family, and now Michael is coming to find her and kill the last of his bloodline. That's the story. And Danielle Harris was only like, what, nine? She was like 9 years old, 10 years old when she first got the role. And, those Halloween movies had to be like the first acting job probably of her entire career. And if it wasn't the first, it had to be one of the first. And she was awesome. She was awesome. But you can't say that those movies were better than the original. That's why I can't sell on the Laurie Strode timeline. Now, I didn't really care much for Halloween H2O, which they had to bring it back again in the late 90s. It was like the Attitude Era. They did another Halloween film. They brought back Jamie Lee Curtis and LL Cool J in a Halloween movie. Actually, you know what? LL Cool J was fine compared to Busta Rhymes. Busta Rhymes was in that Resurrection movie they did. The hell am I concerned about LL Cool J for? Busta Rhymes was like one of the big heroes in a Halloween movie. It's like, ugh, please.
Macho Man Randy Savage, Sarasota, Florida. Come on in. You're going to be defending against the Dragon, Ricky Steamboat. What's the cup for?
WrestleMania 3, Pontiac, Michigan. Yeah, 90,000 plus people watching right there. And this is Ricky the Dragon Steamboat's cup of coffee in the big time. Yeah, cup of coffee in the big time. Because you'll never get closer than now. I am the Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion. And I will remain the Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion. And George the Animal Steel on the outside will be no factor, yeah.
You say no factor. Obviously, he is a factor, or you wouldn't even brought it up.
Oh, wow. Mr. Sarcasm, yeah. I don't care if you got 23 wrestlers around the outside, and it doesn't even matter. No, because I am ready, and I will not let this opportunity slip through my fingers. Cup of coffee, man, yeah. Man! Wow, man, freaked out!
I love when the Coke finally kicks in there at the end. You get that little pause. It was like, wow. That was a classic Macho Man Randy Savage promo there. One of his more famous ones. Cup of coffee in the big time. And that is one of the honorable mentions that I have here on my list as we continue in the countdown of my top nine favorite, in my opinion, the greatest WWE promos / interviews of all time. I said that we are going to reveal number one on the 9-year anniversary show, which is next Sunday, November 6th. That'll be episode 468 of The Sound Off. I will reveal the number one greatest promo in WWE history. But before then, I wanted to show some love to some honorable mentions that did not make the list, but are absolutely worth going out of your way to see or listen to. And so I figured because it was a top nine countdown, why don't I just round up nine honorable mentions? So that's what I have here. That was one that you heard there, that Macho Man promo. Not the last Macho Man promo that I'm going to play here. In fact, I have another one to play right now, and I'm not playing all nine. I'm going to play some of them, some of the shorter ones, the longer ones. I'm not going to play the actual audio, but there is another Macho Man Randy Savage one that I would be remiss if I did not include in my list of honorable mentions. This one being the famous Cream of the Crop promo from the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Probably one of the, if not the most, often imitated professional wrestler as far as Halloween costumes go. Hogan and Savage, they gotta be the top two. Anyway, here's the Macho Man.
It's a day that I'm certain my guest at this time will not forget. I'm talking about the former Intercontinental Champion of the World, Macho Man Randy Savage.
Nothing means nothing. Nothing means nothing, man.
Nothing means nothing. What do you mean by that?
More. I'm talking about all the way to the top, yeah. Unjustifiably in a position that I'd rather not be in. But the cream will rise to the top, oh yeah. Macho Madness, yeah, has got more to offer than President Jack Tunney thinks that I got. Yeah, and I'm going to tell you something right now. Cards stacked against the Macho Man Randy Savage in WrestleMania 3. Yeah, let me say it, yeah. Let me say it out loud. And let me point to the president of the World Wrestling Federation. The Macho Man Randy Savage is not happy with your decision, yeah. I am the cream in the World Wrestling Federation.
Wait a minute,
and there is no doubt about it. Yeah, you mean Gene Okerlund. You know that I'm the cream of the crop.
Well, wait a minute, though, Randy. I've got to ask you very seriously. Do you blame Mr. Jack Tunney, the distinguished president of the World Wrestling Federation, for Ricky Steamboat being the Intercontinental Champion today?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Outside interference, yeah. In my moment of glory. Yeah, no, I'm living in a nightmare. And I am the cream. And now, not only the Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship belt must fall, but the World Heavyweight Championship belt. Because Hulk Hogan, yeah, I am the cream, yeah. The cream of the crop. And there is no one that does it better than the Macho Man Randy Savage. On balance, off balance, doesn't matter. I'm better than you are, yeah. And I'm talking to everyone in the World Wrestling Federation. And I'm even talking to President Jack Tunney, yeah. I'm on my way. And nothing is gonna stop me. Nothing's gonna stop me.
You know, just out of curiosity, Randy, and I certainly don't want to diminish your tremendous God-given talents, but I'm very curious. I haven't seen Elizabeth lately.
Yeah, she's on the outside of the ring. Does she interfere in matches? Yeah. Nothing, zero, yeah. Pure athlete, yeah. And I've been, maligned from the top to the bottom. And because they can't handle the Macho Man Randy Savage, the cream of the crop, nobody does it better.
Well, he's right about that. Nobody does it better. When I go back and I listen to the Macho Man promos, I can't imagine somebody like him coming along today. Like, there's nobody with that voice. There's nobody with that level of intensity. Even back then, you know? I mean, there were guys that could be intense. And sometimes people joke, oh, it was the drugs. I'm sure drugs had a lot to do with that. But Savage was just like always this intense guy, and that was his real, that was his voice, and there is nobody like the Macho Man. And what was cool about that promo, the whole, you know, the whole nothing means nothing. I don't even know what that means, but it sounds cool. And he's got his use of props. So you couldn't see it because all I did was play the audio, but I would implore you to go find the video because he's got these little coffee creamer cups. He probably didn't even give it much thought. He knew he had to do promos. Maybe it was one of those marathon nights at the tapings at 1 o'clock in the morning where they're just taping promo after promo after promo. And he probably just looked over and saw these little coffee creamer cups and grabbed them. And he's trying to balance them, one of them on his head, and it falls off. And like as soon as it falls off, he doesn't miss a beat. He's just like, he puts in this line there about, oh, balanced, unbalanced, it doesn't matter. Like, he was a one-of-a-kind guy. I miss the Macho Man. Speaking of one-of-a-kind and all-time great promos, how can you have a list or honorable mentions without mentioning Jake the Snake Roberts? And one of his better promos was the one that he cut on the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, before their match at WrestleMania 6. This is the famous Muck of Avarice promo.
Jake the Snake Roberts, the match is at hand.
Well, well, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. Here we are at WrestleMania, and it's the biggest match of your career. Why? Because everything you stand for is on the line. Namely, the million-dollar belt. Oh, yeah. It can be yours once again. You see, all you have to do to get it back is go through Damien and me. But you see, Damien and I don't forget. We remember all the times you made people grovel for your money. These were people far less fortunate than you. People who could use your money for essentials. And what did you do? You made fun of them. You humbled them, and you humiliated them. Well, now it's my turn. I'm going to make you beg, DiBiase. You are going to get down on your hands and knees. This time, you'll be the one that's humbled. This time, you'll be the one that's humiliated. And this time, you will be the one that grovels for the money. And how appropriate that the money you grovel for is your very own. A victim of your own greed, wallowing in the muck of avarice.
Longfellow couldn't have said it better.
I love Mean Gene just like sticking these comments in it. Mean Gene is one of the constants in these promos. So the first two Savage ones that I played, this one from Jake, the next one I'm about to play, Mean Gene deserves a lot of credit too because he was the perfect guy for these guys to play off of. Mean Gene was awesome. But what was so great about Jake, you know, in that promo in particular, you know, he's facing DiBiase, he's all about the money. Like, I didn't even know what avarice meant. Like, the first time I heard that, I didn't know what it meant. You know, it's like extreme greed. Like, DiBiase, he's a greedy guy, it's all about the money. I thought avarice was a freaking, like an island somewhere. Like, I didn't know. So, he had this uncanny ability. And other guys have tried it. I think Jericho, I don't know if Jericho's ever admitted this or not, but I would love to ask him if I ever had the chance to interview him. When he came back and he was doing the heel Jericho gimmick as the world champion in 2008, he did this thing where he would speak very, very low on purpose. And that was a mechanism to get people to, they'd have to work that much harder to pay attention to what you were saying. You don't go out there, everybody screams and shouts and hollers. Look at Mick Foley on Raw last week, right? He's shouting like a madman. But Jake was very, very low key. You know, he kept his voice very low. You'd have to really kind of lean in and pay attention to what he was saying. And he did that throughout his career. Now, when he did yell and scream, which he did from time to time, it was like, whoa, because that really wasn't his style. But in this promo, you heard it there. He's a very low talker. You have to really pay attention to what he's saying. Kind of sounds creepy. That's another thing about being a low talker like that. It kind of unnerves you a little bit. Like, why is this guy so calm? Why is he speaking so low? He didn't need to scream and shout to get his point across. This next promo should be no surprise to anybody, except maybe that it's not number one in the countdown, but I was not going to not mention this, and this is one of the greatest promos in WWE history, and again, Mean Gene is a big part of it as well. Ric Flair came into the World Wrestling Federation, and before long, he found himself part of the Royal Rumble, which was for the vacant championship. The title had been held up. Flair was number three. He lasted all the way to the end. Still to this day, the greatest Rumble match of all time, both in terms of the match itself, commentary, the title being on the line, the star power in the match, everything about it was just great. So after the match, Flair goes backstage. They're going to present him. President Jack Tunney is going to hand him the World Wrestling Federation Championship belt. They're there for the title presentation. This is Ric Flair's post-Royal Rumble 1992 acceptance speech, I guess you would say, or promo after winning the WWF Championship for the very first time.
All right, by virtue of winning the Royal Rumble, we have a brand new World Wrestling Federation champion as the press watches on. At this time, to present the title belt to the new champion, our president, the distinguished Jack Tunney.
Congratulations, Ric Flair, on becoming the undisputed champion of the World Wrestling Federation.
Let me just say, after Vito distorting the belt, they're proclaiming the real world champion. I'm going to tell you all, with a tear in my eye, this is the greatest moment in my life. When you walk around this world and you tell everybody you're number one, the only way you get to stay number one is to be number one. And this is the only title in the wrestling world that makes you number one. When you are the king of the WWF, you rule the world. Think about it like that, Mr. Perfect.
Guys, the brain.
Woo!
Woo!
Woo! Let's give a big one! Woo!
You did it!
I was never so impressed with anything I've ever seen in all my life. He went out there for over 60 minutes, never took a back step, took it to Hogan, took it to The Undertaker, took it to whoever got in that ring. That's why he is,
hey,
and he's called now the real world's heavyweight champion.
We're not the kind of guys to say, we told you so, but we... told you so.
Okay, very good. Ric Flair, you have made world... Put that cigarette out. You have made World Wrestling Federation history here tonight.
It's the greatest moment of my life. I want to jump. I want to party. But I got to tell you like this. For the Hulk Hogans and the Macho Mans and the Pipers and the Sids, now it's Ric Flair. And y'all pay homage to the man. Woo! I love it!
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps it up. We hope you have enjoyed your Royal Rumble.
So awesome. So awesome. Just the way he put over the importance of the championship, and clearly that was a jab at WCW. It had to be. Whether it was his own doing or something they told him to say, he made it very clear that the only championship that meant anything was that Winged Eagle belt. And calling it the greatest moment of his entire life, even more so, I guess, than the birth of his kids. But here's the other part that I've never gotten an answer to this. And again, I'd love to ask him one day if I ever have the chance to do so. Yeah, the infamous part of the promo where Mean Gene is interviewing him, and he turns to somebody off camera and just is like, "Put that cigarette out." And I always just figured it was probably just a rib. Maybe there wasn't even anybody that, like, standing there with a cigarette or whatever. And he was just, I don't know, just doing it for the hell of it. Or maybe there was. I never got an answer as to what the hell happened. What, like, has anybody even asked Mean Gene about that? Because if they have, if he's ever done, like, a shoot interview and it was brought up, I don't remember hearing about this. It's like this great unsolved mystery to me after all these years. So I would love to know the story behind that, who he was yelling at. And I don't know, maybe we'll find out one of these days. Somebody needs to ask Mean Gene about that. This next promo was 6 days before WrestleMania 15. The main event of WrestleMania was set to be Stone Cold challenging The Rock for the WWF Championship. This was the night of the famous beer truck incident on Raw. But before Austin took a hose to Rock and McMahon, and I guess it was Vince and Shane, before he hosed them down in brown-colored water, maybe it was real beer. Didn't look like real. It was Coors Light. Probably wasn't real beer. Stone Cold was standing on top of the beer truck. And he was pissed off, as Stone Cold always was. Plus, he was going through a divorce at the time, so I'm sure he really was pissed off. And he cut a promo on The Rock heading into their WrestleMania main event. A promo with, again, I talked about Macho Man and his intensity. I watch these old promos, and the one common thread is there is an intensity that is missing from promos today. I enjoyed Mick Foley's intensity, forced as it kind of felt on Raw Monday night, but he was intense when he was talking about the pain that he's always in, bone on bone in the hip joint. No matter how much weight I lose, I'm always in pain, and you women better be... Like, I like that, and I want to see more of that kind of stuff because I don't see anybody with this level of intensity anymore. And Austin didn't even really have to try. He just walked out there and looked pissed off at the world every single week. And he was pissed off at The Rock, and he wasn't going to have any more of his crap. And so this was the promo that Steve Austin cut on The Rock, standing on top of the beer truck 6 days before WrestleMania.
If you're ready for WrestleMania, give me a hell yeah! You damn right, because Stone Cold Steve Austin has been jerked around long enough. And I will say this, with Paul White as a special referee or without him, it really don't make a damn, because that belt is coming with me, and that's all I got to say about that. For the last few weeks, shut your little lips. Why come that punch your little glasses off right now? For the last few weeks, I come out here and I sit here and listen to you spend your little nursery rhymes about Jabroni Avenue or Know Your Role Boulevard. Jesus Christ, son, you better get your ass serious, because Stone Cold Steve Austin is going to take his ass to Philadelphia, check right in to the SmackDown Hotel, roll right in to room 316, and burn that son of a bitch to the ground. Look at me. Take your little glasses off so I can see your eyeballs, son. Pull them off, because I want you to look right here. When that bell rings and the match is over, you are looking at the next WWF champion, and that's the bottom line for Stone Cold Simpson.
How does that not get you fired up? Like, you don't have a pulse if that doesn't get you fired up. That's final hype right there for a WrestleMania main event. And again, you couldn't see it there. You have to go back and watch it. It's on the network. But the intensity in his eyes, the intensity in his voice, and then, of course, the beer truck incident, which is one of the best, most memorable segments they've ever done. I especially like the story that Austin told once. You couldn't see it, because if you watch the segment, you could see kind of the moment that Austin turns the hose on himself, but then they cut away. And apparently he didn't realize the intensity of the hose, and he almost killed himself. He almost drowned himself in beer. You know, but he's spraying the first five rows. He's spraying everybody in the ring. But, you know, what gets lost is the fact that he cut one of the best promos I've ever heard him cut there before that beer truck incident. And the promo itself doesn't really get talked about a lot, but I thought Austin was at his best there. I just thought he was on fire and the crowd was into it. It was awesome. So those are the promos that I have audio that I'm going to play here. These other promos, I would encourage you to go find them, whether it's on the network, on YouTube, or what have you. I'm not going to play the audio for these, but these also deserve honorable mention here on this list. One of them is Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman was already on the countdown itself, the kind of work shoot that he cut on Vince McMahon on SmackDown back in 01. But Paul Heyman has done some of the best work of his career in just the last few years since coming back with Brock Lesnar. And in my opinion, probably the best promo that he has cut since coming back in, I guess, 2012 it would have been, is his 21-1 promo. The night after WrestleMania 30, it was the night after Brock broke the streak and beat The Undertaker. It came out on Raw in New Orleans. I was there. Heyman, the crowd still was shell-shocked by what happened the night before. And Heyman went out there. He cut this long, like, 10-minute promo. Easily, in my opinion, the best that he's done since coming back, which says a lot. One of my favorite parts of the promo was where he refers to JBL as John Bradshaw Layfield, and those two other things that call themselves announcers sitting next to you, which at the time was Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, although these days I'd lump JBL into that category too. And he's talking about how the night before you had 80,000 people screaming and you know, giving a standing ovation for The Undertaker at the Superdome, and he just turns and he goes, Superdome Hogan, not Silverdome, because Hogan flubbed his lines the night before. And everybody cheers and laughs. And the point of all this was, you can't understand how everybody's giving a standing ovation to The Undertaker, the guy who lost when Brock Lesnar, the fighter that he is, has always taught me that in every fight you've got a winner and you've got a loser. And last night, The Undertaker was a loser. And that was just one small snippet of a much longer promo, but I would, again, encourage you all to go find it, because that 21-1 speech he gave that night to me is probably the best Paul Heyman promo since he came back. Eddie Guerrero just celebrated a birthday. I think he would have turned 49 or 50, I think he would have turned. Sasha Banks has certainly not stopped talking about Eddie, and deservedly so, because Eddie Guerrero was great, and Eddie Guerrero should always be remembered. And some of the best work he ever did, maybe not in the ring, because he was very beaten down and broken down there by the end. He was still having good matches, but he really came into his own as a promo and a heel in the last year of his life. And it was on SmackDown in May of 2005 that Eddie cut this. It was basically the Eddie Guerrero heel turn promo. He had just turned on his best friend, Rey Mysterio, viciously attacked him. He came out on SmackDown. It was a darkened arena. There was nothing, just a chair sitting in the ring. And he sat in the chair and he pulled out Ray's mask that he had pulled off his head. He looked at the mask. He was talking to the mask. Really creepy stuff. This was the Ray-Eddie feud that eventually culminated in that ladder match at SummerSlam for custody of Ray's son, Dominic. Not the greatest storyline those two have ever been involved in, but nonetheless, Eddie still, again, verbally and in that heel role, was doing some of the best work of his career. And it's really sad that it was only a few months later that he passed away. I mean, this promo was in May. In November, he died. So he didn't have a lot of time left. But he was still, you know, he was still going out there. And this, you go back and watch it, it's kind of disturbing, actually. It's a little bit creepy. But still one of the best promos that I've ever heard Eddie Guerrero give. Was this heel turn promo on SmackDown. And lastly here, I believe this is 9, hopefully I didn't miscount, but rounding out the list here of honorable mentions in no particular order, I have to show some love to the sit-down interview that Jim Ross did with Steve Austin and The Rock in the home stretch as they were building to what some would say is the greatest WrestleMania of all time, WrestleMania 17 in the Houston Astrodome, Austin vs. Rock for the championship. Austin, you look back on this, and Austin comes off as almost desperate. And maybe it was a little bit of a foreshadowing, it was a foreshadowing, looking back on it, to the heel turn at WrestleMania. But I thought both of them were really good. Austin in particular, Austin tells him, I need to beat you, Rock. I need to beat you more than anything that you could ever imagine. It's just two guys, two of the biggest stars in wrestling. Jim Ross is kind of the moderator. He's the referee in the middle. There's no crowd. They're not playing crowd. I don't think they had crowd noise. I could be wrong about that, but I don't remember there being crowd noise in the background. So you don't have people catcalling and doing stupid what chants and all that BS. They're in the back, in the locker room. It's just the three of them, and Jim Ross is kind of directing traffic. And that's all they had to really do to build this match of WrestleMania. I mean, that match kind of sold itself anyway to, you know, the two biggest baby faces in the company. I know that, I think on SmackDown they had one where they, I think, saluted each other with beer and then they attacked each other. But this sit-down interview that JR did with these two guys was awesome. And I wish they would do more stuff like this. I feel like they don't do enough of it. They do those Michael Cole sit-down interviews that air on WWE.com. Or as he would say, WWE.com. So they do those, and yeah, that's kind of what I'm talking about here. I wish they would do that. But, you know, in this kind of setting where you have somebody sitting between these two guys, big pay-per-view main event coming up, this was taped earlier in the day, in the back, no crowd, don't do those stupid crowd cuts. Just, you know, two guys sitting there, jaw-jacking back and forth, hyping up a match. Very simple. And I wanted to show this some love because I thought this was awesome. And I wish they would look back every now and then, because I get the impression they don't. Look back at some of the stuff that they've already done 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago. And you can borrow from that, you know, and incorporate some of that into what you do now. Because it worked then, right? It worked then. I guarantee you some of that same stuff would work today. So that's my list of honorable mentions. Had to get some Macho Man in there and Jake and Flair and a lot of good stuff on that list. But ultimately, there is only one spot left in the countdown. Number one, the number one greatest promo or interview in the history of that company, in my opinion. I will reveal that on the show next weekend. Keep guessing. Some of you have come up with some very interesting guesses. I won't say whether you're hot or cold. I'm not going to give away any hints. But I think if you look back at what I've had in the countdown so far, you might quibble about the order that this stuff is in, but I think a lot of you would probably agree that the stuff that I've had on the countdown so far is worthy of being on there. So just, you know, trust me. I think you'll enjoy what I have in the top spot. Follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle. I'll be live tweeting tonight during the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, as I do during the week, during Raw and all the other big events. And we are getting closer to 20,000 followers on there. So help me out. Help me get to 20K @Solomonster. I will also have a Hell in a Cell poll up after the pay-per-view tonight, as I do during Raw Monday night. So if you want to vote, thumbs up, thumbs down. If you want your voice to be heard, follow me on there and vote in the poll. And one final plug here for the Hell in a Cell review I'm going to be doing, Sound Off Extra. It will go up tonight, not on the YouTube channel. Tonight it will go up on SE Scoops' mobile app exclusively in the SE Scoops mobile app. You can download it for free right now if you have an iPhone, an Android. Get the app. When the extra is uploaded, it should be pinned at the top. You'll be able to listen to it or stream it through the app for the first 24 hours. After those 24 hours are over, it'll hit YouTube for everybody else, as it usually does. But if you don't want to wait that long, SE Scoops app is the place to go for that. And keep supporting the show. I appreciate everybody who does so. Keep spreading the word. I want to show some love to TV Tracks. I want to show some love also even to Wrestle Talk TV, showing love to the podcast last week on their channel. The easiest way is to just keep telling people about the show. If you like what you hear, if you think they're going to like what they hear, maybe they've never heard of me before, I'm confident enough in my own work and the show every week that I think people are going to like what they hear. So I say thank you to everybody who keeps spreading the good word and making PayPal donations and using our Audible link. It's very much appreciated. Next weekend is the 9-year anniversary podcast, episode 468. I can't believe it's been that long, but it is indeed going to be 9 years. So hopefully you'll join me for that celebration. And until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy Hell in a Cell tonight. Stay safe if you're going out for Halloween. And we'll see you back here next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off. What?
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the big show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.